You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Flashpoints. Where are the children? We'll hear the story of a Salvadoran woman whose two children were taken from her and based on false pretenses that they would soon be returned. Believe me, they weren't. Also breaking at this hour, we have a letter from refugee parents with separated families in response to the new executive order from the U.S. president. We'll hear that in the voice of one of those parents. We'll speak to a frontline immigration lawyer working on the Mexican side of the border on asylum cases. Also, we'll be joined by Alex Mensing of Sin Fronteras, an activist doing refugee work at the border and here in San Francisco. And our own Francisco Herrera will join us from Borderland. We'll also get an indigenous perspective on the breaking up of families, the official mass kidnapping of brown kids, and the shredding of the political asylum program. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our drumbeat coverage of the kidnapping, the current administration's kidnapping, Donald Trump's kidnapping of hundreds, stealing children, hiding them. Who knows where they are now? Who knows what danger? We know that some of them have been beaten. Some of them have been brutalized. Don't know where a lot of them are. They're in danger. They're definitely out there in limbo. That's the story of the day. That's the story in this country. And that's the story we're going to pursue today. Joining us first is Alex Mensing with Sin Fronteras. Alex, welcome to Flashpoints. Alex Mensing, are you there? All right, we're gonna reach out to him. In the studio with me is Miguel Gavila Molina. Miguel, we're watching this unfold. In about a moment, we're gonna hear a statement read by one of the parents. I believe one of the imprisoned parents. Yes. About their kids being stolen. How we doing there, Mike? We've got him. All right, we're gonna try him again.
Well, this is an international crisis, and now the world is watching. And I believe over 100 countries have already condemned the assault on these children, the most vulnerable. We're talking about, you know, infants, babies, toddlers. And this is a human rights crisis that we've been talking about. But it's also Trump's administration's way of turning human tragedy, exploiting the situation for profit, for gain. These pop-up towns that are so-called being constructed to house these children and women, refugees, are all somehow located now on military bases, military installations, which are off limits to civilian, which are off limits to politicians, off limits to anybody, the public.
Listen, let's do this, Mike. We're going to go to the statement just released before airtime. This is a letter from refugee parents with separated families in response to the new executive order from the U.S. president. Miguel will translate. It's in the voice from one of the parents, one of the imprisoned parents. Let's run that and then we'll go back to Alex. The board just froze.
Yeah, I think it's real clear. I mean, I heard the statement, and it's, you know, parents coming here. They're not coming here to, you know, cross the border illegally, you know, jump over the fence or the wall or whatever. They're coming here fleeing unbelievable violence. Some of these families have had, some of these women have had their husbands killed, their brothers killed, you know, family members, you know, murdered by gangs or even by military death squads. I mean, this is violence that people are fleeing, and they came here seeking refuge after traveling, not just, you know, from El Salvador, but having to go through, you know, Guatemala, having to go through Mexico, and then finally making it to the border seeking refuge. They are allowed to come in, then they're arrested. Arrested and then criminalized. Once you're arrested by the INS, you become, in a sense, you violated federal law, you've committed a felony, you're a criminal. That gives the government, or that gives the INS the power to separate you from your children. And that is a crisis that is happening.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to get Alex in a moment. Is that what you said? Okay, let's go with the sound here. So this is, again, this is a letter from refugee parents, one of the moms of the imprisoned parents reading, and Miguel is going to translate. Let's try this again.
Querida y estimado presidente, reciban por bien. Saludo, esperando que se encuentren muy bien de salud.
We hope that people come okay and they arrive here in good health. The reason for this letter is something that we mentioned, coming to the border. Thank goodness, God, that we arrived at Tijuana. I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old. We came together here on a Sunday. Once we arrived, the agents took in only 50 people a day. We had to wait. 2 days later, they finally processed us. And coming in for the caravan, I was fortunate for me and my two children. We went to the front. They allowed us to come at night. They took me and my two kids. Then they sat us down. They asked me, why are you here? Well, I said, I'm afraid to stay in my country. They asked the documents, birth certificates of my sons, on a documentation from the Salvador. And they called us to take fingerprints and photographs. Afterwards, they took us. They took us in. At 5 o'clock this Thursday, they asked me to come to an interview at 5 a.m. and left my two kids. Then they returned me back around 8 o'clock. And then they called my two kids without me. They said that they were only going to ask them a few questions, and then they're going to release them. Then they called me, and they asked me more questions. And then, around 8 o'clock in the morning, they called my two sons, and they told me. I asked them, where are they going? Where there's more children, they told me. You can't separate me from my kids. They're kids. They're children. Well, I had a card that says that I'm the mother, and I don't want to be separated. They told me that here has no worth. Well, where are they? Where's their destination? They told me. You got 10 minutes to say goodbye to them. That's all they told me. Afterwards, they can't stay with you. And then they told me. My oldest 7-year-old started to cry. He said, Mommy, I don't want to leave. I don't want them to take me. I don't want to get separated. And the other little one started to cry even more. I felt so bad. I, by myself, embrace them. Go, and God will help you, will help us. Take care of your little brother. And I will be praying for you, for all of us. And the officials came for them. And they took the little one. I told him to put him down. And then he took the older one. And both of them. And when they realized I wasn't coming, they started even crying louder until they were taken away. And then I asked them, where are you taking them? All they told me, they will explain later. And then they took me back to the refrigerated room. They took them, and I asked them the next day, where are my kids? They didn't know anything. I asked another official. They didn't know. And said he'd investigate. And then he returned. And he told me. They called your uncle. And see if they received. And then they said that they tried to reach my uncle. But they're in detention. And then I asked them. They asked. They told me. We did make him a call. They said that they had called my uncle. He asked my uncle to send documents. Who knows where they are? My uncle finally told me. They said that they're okay. But he's been waiting for a response. My children, where are they? They said they might give them to my uncle. But I don't know. He, my uncle, did give them documents, did give them papers they needed. The caravan brought us here. If I knew that the caravan was going to reach to this, I would have thinking much more about this. I wanted to get away from danger. If we would have stayed in El Salvador, might have killed one of my sons, might have disappeared. It became clear I had to bring him with me. What is happening to us is unjust. It really hurts me deeply. I'm just frustrated, emotionally distraught. I want my kids. I want peace and tranquility. I want to have them next to me. I cry at night when they're not here, but they need to be with me. All I want to say to you, think for a minute and put yourself in my shoes. And I am sure that the majority who have kids, you will feel what I feel for a minute if you were separated from your children. You would feel the pain that I feel as a mother. That way you would understand. Why would you separate your parents from your kids? This isn't right in this country. We suffer so much, and my kids suffering separated from me. All I say is for a minute, look in your heart and feel what I feel. How it feels to be separated from your children. I'm asking, I am suffering greatly. We are not criminals. We are all people. We want to be well with my kids. And don't criminalize the caravan. They try to help us. I appreciate and I thank them.
Primero Dios, todo me saldrá bien.
God will eventually protect us and everything will give us. He will make sure. I'm just a mother. I'm not a writer. I'm not a speaker. But I'm speaking out for the injustice separating me from my kids. Please, I hope it reaches your heart. We're not criminals. We're not animals. That's your attention, Maria.
And again, I should tell you, we're having a lot of problems here with our switchboard. But let me tell you, that was a statement. It wasn't from the a group of parents. That was from a particular woman from El Salvador that had her two kids taken away from her in a very they were 7 years old and 2 years old. And they were taken in the most deceptive and brutal way. Did you hear, can I go with my kids? No, you're going somewhere, says the folks from the U.S. You're going somewhere where your child can't go. Oh, well, his child, that's true, but the child is also going to prison. Right now, she does not know where those children are, whether they will be given to her uncle. And I think what we're going to do here while we continue to try and call people, Mike, is let's Oh, we've got Alex. Alex, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Dennis.
Sorry about that. Some major technical stuff. That's Alex Mensing from Sin Fronteras. We just had the heart-wrenching experience of listening to that mom who had her 7-year-old and 2-year-old taken away from her. Could you give us a little bit more background on that? Or what's the context there?
Yeah, thanks for talking about this on the show. Maria was one of the mothers who came on the refugee caravan. She fled El Salvador due to violence and persecution and death threats that she was receiving. And she was aware, as all of the parents on the caravan were, that there was a possibility of family separation. But everyone went in prepared with identity documents, government-issued documents, to be able to show the family relationship and sworn declarations about their family relationship. Despite that, she and several other of the parents who turned themselves in at a port of entry after having to literally set up an encampment and demand that the U.S. government respect their right to seek asylum, literally for a week outside of the port of entry when Customs and Border Protection didn't want to let them in. Unfortunately, after a few days in what's called the ice box, what happened that we heard in that recording happened, which is that she was told by ICE agents that she had to go elsewhere, and she was taken to Otay Mesa Detention Center right after that traumatic separation, and her children were sent to an Office of Refugee Resettlement facility, and it took a while to figure out where they were. I still don't know the name of the facility, but she's been able to at least have a better idea of where they are, but is still almost 2 months later trying to get them to be able to be released from, you know, they've been incarcerated in one of these child facilities for nearly 2 months now. The uncle has still not managed to get them out. She was told that she had to do a DNA test, and then the agency that runs the DNA tests couldn't find her. I don't know how you can not find somebody who's incarcerated in an immigration detention center, but she's been battling with this problem along with several other mothers and fathers now for nearly 2 months.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Alex Mensing. He works with Sin Fronteras. He's been at the border. He's been on the front lines fighting this battle, watching it evolve to the point where it is now of a sort of, I don't know how many thousands of kids are missing. But let's we've got a breaking story here as well. There was a letter released from refugee parents with separated families in response to the new executive order from the U.S. President. Alex, could you give us some context on this? And then we're going to hear one of the parents reading from the letter, and Miguel will translate.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a number of parents who were separated who have reached out to various organizations, including Pueblos Sin Fronteras, some of whom participated in the caravans or met each other in detention, who've experienced this problem as far back as months ago, being separated okay. from their children, and some who were recently separated from their children, and they've spoken to each other. The relatives were outside trying to get the kids out of the immigration, the child immigration centers, the Office of Refugee Resettlement centers, family members of the parents, even people back in their home countries. As one of the mothers says frequently, family separation is the problem not just for the kid and the parent, but for the entire family and the community that's affected by it. And so they began speaking to each other, calling each other, reading each other's letters, and they decided to get together and say something about this, particularly because it's unfortunately not common for people in the United States to listen to the voices of Central Americans. And at the very least, now they're interested in this family separation issue because of the horrible news that everyone's been seeing. So they got together, they began sharing their ideas, and Pueblos Sin Fronteras helped put them together, combine them into a document that then everybody read, and one of the mothers read the finalized version, which was just finished today.
All right, let's hear that. That's what we haven't heard this yet. This is from the letter. Let's run that now, Mike.
Comunicado de padres refugiados con familias separadas.
This is a communication to families of separated families. This is to the United States President, to the people of the United States, and to the President of the country.
Nosotros y nosotras.
We hear us.
Parents,
refugees from families that have been separated with kids and imprisoned. We are fleeing cruel violence, and we come here traumatizing us and incarcerating us. We come to this country obligated so we can live.
Negamos a la condena a muerte a la que estamos sometidas por la violencia en nuestros propios países.
We condemn the violence that's happening against our own country that originated here in the United States because of the conflict in Central America. We come here confronted by inhumanity by the United States. This new order, the strategy of this president to shut us up and to intimidate the undocumented persons. This president are not helping us. Families continue to be separated, tortured in their incarceration. This is unbelievable by the Trump administration. How can you separate children from their parents? Our community are in continued imprisonment. They continue to live in trauma. The only difference, some of these children might be with one of their people, one of their parents, but will be detained. They'll continue to live incarcerated. Unbelievable, unjust. It's psychological war. This new order doesn't do anything to help immigrant families. Our rights are being violated by separating families. It's a physical and emotional trauma. Doesn't even consider humanity and dignity for humanity people. This is our families. You can't continue to mistreat children and parents. You can't incarcerate parents. It's tremendous trauma that everybody's facing and coming to terms with. We come to this country and asking this government to work to contribute. We don't come in here to subject our kids to psychological terror. Anywhere in the world, parents and kids should not be incarcerated. The separation. This is political strategies criminal. This violation. It only benefits the corporations.
Este es un llamado a las comunidades.
We're calling the community.
A los mismos migrantes y a las
to all undocumented and migrants.
Ahora es el momento de
this is the moment.
Y no quedarnos callados frente
we are not going to be silent. This is the moment to rise up and speak out.
Al final del túnel hay una clara victoria que debemos
until there's a clear victory. Humanity for all people and solidarity.
Para refugiados con familias separadas, nuestros nombres serán protegidos para evitar represalias del gobierno con nuestras familias.
We will stay together and unify to stop the maltreatment of this government against our families.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That was part of a statement just finished today. Letter from refugee parents with separated families in response to the new executive order from the U.S. president. We've had on the line with us Alex Mensing, also joining us from the Mexican side of the border, I believe, is Nicole Ramos. She is with El Otro Lado, the other side, and she's an attorney on the front lines of this story. Nicole, could you tell us what you've been doing today, what you've been up to, what your life has been like in the context of this latest ramping up of the war on children, I guess you could say brown children coming up from Central America?
Well, currently we have human rights monitors, short-term human rights monitors that are monitoring conditions at the port of entry. They report back that Customs and Border Protection officials continue to turn people away, including families with children, including very young children. And those individuals are waiting for days and weeks in order to be processed, and they are desperate because they're fleeing. And a certain percentage of those people do attempt to enter through irregular means out of desperation. And so that's one piece of what we're doing. The other piece is we're receiving referrals from our local federal public defender's office of individuals who've been prosecuted under the zero tolerance policy and who've been separated from their children. So we're trying to help those individuals locate their children. And just this morning, one of my colleagues here, Erica Pinheiro, she had a call with a father who is now in Guatemala, who was removed without his child. His child is still in the United States.
How old is his child? How old?
I don't know how old his child is because it's not a case I'm working on. But
I see. And do you think that's happened a great deal? What do we know about how often it happens where the parent is deported and the kid is left in the country?
I don't know that we know nearly enough as we should know about it because people are not given information on how to navigate the system in order to find their child. They're given a phone number, and it can take weeks for them to figure out where their child is. If they're a person who is going back to a place where they don't have access to a phone or they don't have access to a computer, they don't know how to let advocates know what's happening to them. I think it's a really unknowable figure at this point.
Which makes them untrackable and thus way more vulnerable, right?
Absolutely. And anytime you have just this wholesale, forcible separation of children from their parents, those are the beginnings of genocide. That is one of the ways that you can commit genocide under the international human rights law. And that's what we have here. It's horrific.
And so I guess you were probably horrified, but you weren't surprised to hear about the stories of kids being locked down, brutalized, drugged to the point where they can't keep their heads up?
Nothing that the Department of Homeland Security does with respect to refugees or immigrants generally surprises me.
We heard reports from the government that they have reunited 500 of the so-called 2,300 families that were separated from their children. Is there any indication of what the facts really are?
Well,
No, there isn't. And one of the interesting things about what the government is not saying is they don't explain why they separated families under this zero tolerance policy, if that's why they're separating families under the zero tolerance policy, because they entered illegally, why they separated families who presented themselves at ports of entry under which is the way that you would begin this process under federal law. So when you understand that, you know that this is not a policy of deterrence. This is a policy, if the only thing they're trying to deter is more asylum seekers from Latin America and other countries of brown-skinned individuals from coming to the border to seek asylum. That's the only deterrent effect that they wish to impart upon refugees.
What are the multiple struggles that you foresee now? What are the things that we're hearing a lot of people are getting involved, a lot of lawyers, but what where is the battle now and where do you see it?
I think the battle is still access to the port of entry, because what CBP is doing along the entire southern border is forcing people to wait for weeks on end, which not only exposes them to the actual elements, such as sitting in the sun for 3 weeks, but it's also exposing them to organized crime, which monitors the ports of entry and looks to take people away for extortion, kidnapping, human trafficking, and forced drug trafficking. But it also subjects them to easy pickings by Mexican immigration, so they can be deported back to largely what is Central America. And so I think it's an access issue, because sooner or later people get tired and they try to enter in through the hills or break in the fence. And so essentially DHS is creating the problem, which they complain about, because they are not directing their federal law enforcement to actually follow the law, and they're not ensuring that they have sufficient staff at the ports of entry to entry to process people. And they do have sufficient staff members. They do have the budget for this. CBP is the largest law enforcement agency in the country. They have the staff. And then the second issue, I think, becomes what the government is going to try and do in terms of attacking the Flores settlement and trying to keep families in long-term detention until their cases are resolved. And that can take a couple of months to a year to wrap up a case in detention. And you're subjecting children to an incarceration setting that is a violation of all medical protocols. Any doctor, any child mental health worker will tell you that is detrimental. And as recently as this afternoon, the UNHCR has indicated that probably qualifies as torture. So not only are they closing off access to refugees in violation of U.S. federal law and U.S. and international law, but then once people do actually make it into the process, then the U.S. government is actively seeking to torture people into order to dissuade them from pursuing in the process.
Well, do you have enough help down there?
No, we do not. We are in need of particularly attorneys and legal workers, advocates that have asylum experience that can help us to screen individuals and families and talk to them about what they're going to face in terms of detention, what their rights are, how U.S. actors are probably going to try to violate their rights, strategies and responses that they themselves can use, and as far as also having to connect with advocates. And, you know, Tijuana is one of the largest cities along the border that receives asylum seekers. It's one of the safer border cities. And so we're just two attorneys down here, and with a city full of asylum seekers, it's hard to meet all of the people that would be necessary to talk to warn them about what to expect.
Wow. Well, we're going to watch it very closely. Thank you for joining us, Nicole Ramos, an attorney working on the Mexican side of the border, working on asylum. And this is really a pre-planned slash-and-burn attack on asylum, on the whole process. on it goes. We thank you for joining us. I hope we can keep this dialogue going with you, Nicole Ramos. Thanks for the incredibly important work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. And still with us is Alex Mensing of Sin Fronteras. And also joining us now is our own Francisco Herrera. But just for a moment, Alex, I wanted to come back to you. And Miguel Molina is in the studio. I want to bring him into this discussion, too. But say a little bit more about the prisoner's statement, because that really represents an extraordinary solidarity. One is getting the feeling that there is a movement being organized out of this struggle.
Absolutely. There's absolutely movement, and people are organizing inside the detention centers as well. Inside Otay Mesa Detention Center, people for a long time have been organizing inside Northwest Detention Center. In Tacoma, last year, there's been a series of events that have been part of this. Last year, there was a series of hunger strikes in Adelanto Detention Center, some of them involving caravan members who are part of a network, who then continue to speak out and support each other. There are people who were formerly detained who are the ones receiving phone calls from currently detained parents and families who were separated, and they all share that experience and they share that information with each other. They are organizing. There are members of the refugee community who are organizing to make their voices heard. And they can see through the government's lies and the government's deception because they're the ones living it on the ground. And so when Trump says he's ending family separation and talks about looking for places to keep them together, they immediately see, they recognize it, that Trump is talking about opening up more private prisons and more family detention centers. And there's some of the people, in fact, the woman who read that letter, she was in a family detention center. She knows what it's like. And so when she thinks about what it would be like to have had to stay there for the duration of her entire immigration proceedings, 4, 6, 8 months, she knows what that means. She knows that that's going to be torture for somebody. So they're not only against family separation, but they're against family detention, and they're against the detention of immigrants in general, because they know that any detention of immigrants is family separation, just like any form of incarceration is family separation. And I think that the strength of their statement comes from the experience that they all have living through these problems. You know, they're the ones who can't afford to stay quiet, and that's why they end their statement saying that it's time to take action. And I think at the end of the day, it's always going to be the people affected by these problems who we see taking the stands that need to be taken. And I hope that the rest of us can stand in solidarity with them and not let up just because Trump says that he's, you know, made an executive order to end family separation, which is going to benefit, as they say, corporations and increase family incarceration.
And it's amazing. We have to say goodbye now, but it is amazing. I've been doing the research on the way in which, as soon as the Trump administration came in, they started hiring companies. They started funding companies. This operation was receiving a lot of attention before it ever surfaced. And they didn't do enough of that stuff. But it's amazing. Hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on this operation before it ever hit the news.
Yep.
So they were planning this. This was the modus operandi all the way. Destroy.
Absolutely, and I think yes.
Go on.
The outrage against family separation is maybe even designed to generate an opportunity to increase incarceration. And I think that one of the next things that we need to see is fights against the new places. We've got to keep our eyes open about where the new detention centers opening. There's just an announcement about potentially using right here in the Bay Area a site for 50,000 immigrants. An old military base. And so we need to keep an eye on where the government is trying to open up new.
How many thousand did you say? How many thousand?
I said 50,000.
50,000.
Yeah, that report just came out today. So I think it's something to look into more and keep an eye on.
All right. Listen, we thank you for joining us, Alex. We hope that we can keep this dialogue going. Obviously, we have to keep a huge spotlight on this. So thanks for joining us. I'm Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilán Molina. In 1 minute, here comes Francisco. But let's listen to a song of his that speaks to this starts at the heart, really.
Son sagrados, bellos son, son el regalo más amado, sagrados son, y aquí están cruzando fronteras, y aquí están trayendo la verdad. Son la voz de Dios y nuestra conciencia, pues por la violencia cruzando están. Nuestros niños son sagrados, ellos son, son el regalo más amado.
Welcome, Francisco Herrera. Thanks for the music. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavilan Molina. And where are you?
Thanks, Dennis. Sorry I'm not with you guys. I'm doing some family care in San Diego at the border and dealing with some family issues, but I'm very happy to be here with you. I know that as we speak, hundreds of people, maybe in the thousands, are preparing. I think there was a march in front of the ICE office today in San Diego on Front Street. And then tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday at Mount Carmel Church, and people are gathering and will be going, I believe, to Otay Mesa, to the punishment center there. And I know on the other side of the border, Marichuy from the National Indigenous Congress is actually in Tijuana, also where people are getting organized. And so here in San Diego.
We were trying to get a congressman from down there on the show, but could you talk a little bit about, what's happening when officials try and protest?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we have to put the big picture just as a framework. The government is very clear of what it's doing, Dennis. Since the early 1990s, when they started proposing free trade agreement, NAFTA, which later was also CAFTA, and all the other policies like Merida Panama Plan, they have been very clear, and all the analysts were very clear. What is happening now was detailed. That's exactly what's going to happen. So it's no mystery, and it's been happening. That's why Operation Gatekeeper was imposed. So what we're facing as U.S. citizens is the imposition of the torture industrial complex, right? The military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, that's what we're facing. And what does that mean, Dennis? It means contracts that the U.S. has made with companies that build the wall in Israel and Palestine and companies that build the same wall. All these companies are all the same, Blackwater and all these torturous companies. And so what we're facing is this, and what I'm glad to see is that people are rising up, because we've been detailing this since 2003, 2004. If you remember, we were identifying a child jail they had in Texas. And 4-5 years ago, we started yelling about this at the Tijuana border. As a matter of fact, the congressperson Juan Vargas, that we were trying to interview, I remember calling him because a woman called us, was able to call their relatives from Otay Mesa, saying they're putting us in these freezers, the cells are being made very, very cold. They're torturing us. There's rape going on here. There's abuse. There's all the things that we are seeing still today have been going on for a long time. But that's because we need to face the fact that our government has made a decision to fund prisons, to fund torture, to fund military profit. And so this is the piece that we have to, as a society, address, Dennis. And it's right down their playbook. I mean, nothing has changed, and they're expanding on it, and it's building profit out of the misery and torture. We have created the situation exactly. We burnt the house of our neighbor, and now the neighbors are coming in trying to rescue their children. And instead of saying, oh, yeah, we burnt the house, we're responsible, we better pay up and give them political asylum, we're taking their kids away and calling them criminals. So that's exactly what's going on, and that's what we need to organize against.
All right.
Or organize for peace, really.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there because we got a bunch more that we need to get on. Francisco Herrera joining us from San Diego, not too far from there. The struggle continues, and obviously we'll keep talking about it. Be careful, Francisco. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gabriel Molina, and we're going to about to go and get a perspective, an indigenous perspective, because there's a great deal going on within the Native American community, within the American Indian movement. You want to set that up, Miguel?
Yes, and of course, you know, what people have to realize is that people coming across are basically indigenous people, Mayan peoples from El Salvador, Guatemala, so forth. And this week, it started yesterday, and it runs to the Sunday. The International Indian Treaty Council has gathered at the Rosebud Bear Butte Lodge in Lakota Nation in South Dakota. The conference theme this year is Treaty Rights to Food, Treaty Rights to Water. And with us, we have the executive director, Andrea Carmen, of the International Indian Treaty Council. There she's there along with Bill Means, American Indian Movement founder, and lots of people from the Americas gathered today here. And I know that she recently they made a resolution. Andrea, are you there? Andrea Carmen is not picking up, but I do know, Dennis, that today they actually, because of the crisis at the border and now the obvious incarceration of kids, they've taken a stand and come out with an international statement. Andrea, are you there?
I'm here, Miguel.
Well, it's good to have you with us, Andrea. You know, with the situation that's happening here at the border between Mexico and the United States as an international crisis, and it looks like the world has condemned the United States for its treatment of refugee folks coming to the border to seek asylum. And I know from talking with you folks earlier that Treaty Council has taken a position.
Yes, we have. Directors meeting that happened a couple of days ago made a resolution and a very strong statement, but we're here at our 44th anniversary international treaty conference in Bear Butte, South Dakota, and this was an issue that was expressed by many of the participants. So we shared the resolution of the board of directors, and they wanted this to be a position of the entire organization, and all of our affiliates are here from several different countries from throughout this hemisphere, as well as the Caribbean and the Pacific Islands that make up the members of the International Treaty Council. So if I could, I'd like to read a couple paragraphs so we see what our position is, not the entire thing, and then I can make this available to you. We're going to be sending it to United Nations human rights bodies and mechanisms that we work with on a regular basis, the government of the United States, the Organization of American States, Inter-American Human Rights Commission, and to world public opinion. So I'll go ahead and just, if I may, Miguel, just
yes.
Read the first couple paragraphs.
Please.
The participants in the 44th anniversary conference of the International Indian Treaty Council in Bear Butte, South Dakota, express our collective outrage regarding cruel, inhumane, and racist policies of the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, to forcibly separate thousands of children from their parents and families along the southern border of the United States. Many of these children are from indigenous communities in Latin America where violence and oppression are rampant. Many are children with disabilities, and many are now being kept in cages like animals with little hope of finding their parents again. Children subjected to such treatment are victims of egregious human rights violations and extreme child abuse at the hands of the U.S. government and its agents. American Indians and Alaska Natives also experience the trauma of being forcibly removed from their parents and families under U.S. boarding school policies carried out in previous centuries. We are brokenhearted to put the lifelong and intergenerational trauma which will impact the children experiencing similar abuses today under U.S. so-called zero-tolerance immigration policy. So that's just the beginning of it, but I think it's pretty clear that our position is here as Indigenous peoples and as an organization, the only Indigenous organization with general consultative status to the UN Economic and Social Council. So we're going to make our views known to the United Nations as well as the United States and to the world about this issue. And I'm going to pass the phone now to Bill Means, one of our founding board members, who is one of the hosts of the conference here at Bear Butte Sacred Site in South Dakota, Ochete Cohen Territory, and can add some additional comments. Thank you.
Mr. Means?
Buenas tardes.
Mr. Bill Means, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine here. His name is Gavilan. Say hello.
How are you, Bill? It's good to have you with us.
Good.
I know you folks have been working out there diligently, and this crisis here at the border is beginning to finally, you know, dominate the news, mainstream media. Everybody's looking at this. But one thing that really bothers me, Bill, and it's something that goes back to the 1800s, early 1900s, and the Indian Wars, is that, you know, the U.S. cavalry and the government at those times, you know, were into separating children from, you know, their parents. And that continued, you know, into the 1900s with boarding school, reform schools, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is part of the genocide. This is part of, you know, destroying the civilization, indigenous civilizations. But recently, this week, we've heard the conversation about that the Department of Justice is sending military lawyers, military prosecutors to the border. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, prosecution. I mean, Bill, these are children. These are women. These are not army combatants. These are not prisoners of war. These aren't soldiers. These are civilians from our neighboring countries. You know, what is the position, you know? And I know that Dennis, I mean, we've been having this conversation. The militarization now, you know, means that, you know, the government here has formed a council of military attorneys to start prosecution. I mean, what is this? It to us, is this a now a war? Are these children and women and families being held as army combatants?
You know, this is the same policy that was perfected on American Indians in not only the last century, but the century before. And according to some of our witnesses and participants in this conference who have talked to their relatives back in the countries of Central South America, there is still an alarming amount of missing children. Not only supposedly Trump issued the order to stop the process, but now what happens to the people that are missing? Now, Trump needs to look into acts of genocide, because that's what he's committing. When you forcibly remove people from their families, from their territories, this is one of the criteria for the definition of genocide. And so we have to treat this to the utmost extreme in order to get the issue of the human rights or genocide into the public debate. Because right now it's being dismissed as something that was happening, but they're not doing it anymore. Well, not only are they still doing it, but they have to account for some children that are missing and haven't been heard of for weeks. And so this is what I guess we're trying to draw attention to bring solidarity to our relatives from Central South America, that this is not a war against civilians, where you can use military attorneys to prosecute indigenous women and children. I mean, what is next? That they're going to use military prosecutors to prosecute those involved in civil disobedience? So these are the questions that we're asking not only the UN, but also the Inter-American Council on Human Rights, to see if there's some semblance of justice for these people on the border that are being forcibly removed and also detained, so, and prosecuted. So these are things that are all mounting up to the definition of genocide. So we stand in solidarity with those people of Central South America who are attempting to come to this country to create a better way of life. We're not asking for welfare. It's saying we'll do the work that no Americans want to do. And so for that, they're being prosecuted. There's even people in the South who need labor, seasonal labor, farm workers who can't get them anymore because of Trump's policies, who have come over here for years to follow the various crops that need harvesting by hand. And so these are some of the people that's being held in detention, that are being held, you know, against their will and wondering where is their children. They used to come with their children all the time. So this is nothing new. And now all of a sudden their children are taken from right there at the border, when all they want is seeking a job, a better way of life, a chance to work just like any other human being does to try to provide for their family. I'll let you do alone.
Bill, this is Dennis here with Miguel. And before we let, we have just a couple minutes left, but would you tell us a little bit more about what's going on where you are now and the significance of the meetings that are taking place and the various rituals?
Bill, this is Andrea again. Oh. Bill just handed the phone back to me. I hope that's okay. We're trying to keep the noise down and not put it on speaker, so we're going back and forth. But this is our 44th International Indian Treaty Council Conference. The last time we were in South Dakota was in 1999, for our 25th anniversary. And I just wanted to make another comment on this issue, is that our board president is from Guatemala, and he received calls already from relatives of his there that they're wondering what happened to their family members, to the grandchildren. You know, they haven't heard from their daughter or son. You know, they're coming here, as Bill said, to work, and some of them have come for many years. And, you know, we've also gotten a call out from people on the border that many of these children do not even speak Spanish. They only speak the indigenous languages. So there's not even any way for the U.S. Health and Human Services or immigration to even talk to some of these kids. You know, they have interpreters in Mayan, you know, or Cachiquel or Zapoteca, or, you know, the different languages. So, you know, this is an atrocity against indigenous peoples, and I think that, you know, we have a collective sense of outrage about what's going on, and we want to stand in solidarity. But this is directly affecting the members and affiliates of the International Union Treaty Council. This isn't happening to somebody else. So that's the position that we're coming through on with this.
That is very powerful, Andrea Carmen. We're out of time, but we thank you and Bill Means for the continuing flow of information. And final word, Miguel. We have 10 seconds.
We're coming back on Monday, and we'll do a complete wrap-up here with you, Andrea, the Treaty Council. And over the weekend, who knows what's going to happen, but let's get ready to take this on again.
All right. Thank you, and stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Today's show was first broadcast in 2013. I've kept most of the original introduction, so when you hear me mention how many years a war has been going on, please add another 5 to the sum. The Afghanistan war has been going on since October 2001. Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll mark the 10th anniversary of our Iraq War by hearing parts of a nice audio collage by Skidmark Bob. It's a blend of movie clips, TV news, popular songs, and one or two documentaries on the lives of our enlisted soldiers still getting shot up in Afghanistan. I hope you'll stay tuned. The United States has been making war against one third world nation or another since I was born. That was 1950. Always a war against some small, poor, third world country, with the one exception of Serbia, a small second world country that did not want to play ball with the IMF or join the European Union. So we bombed Belgrade, claiming we did it to protect the Muslim community within Bosnia. Makes perfect sense to me, but I digress. Skidmark Bob has a blog and also a show on America's premier pirate radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz. He engineered this audio collage a couple years ago to mark the 10th anniversary of our war against Afghanistan. It's called Decade War. It's an hour long, so we'll hear just part of it. For me, the best parts are the voices of the American and British soldiers sent off to Afghanistan to fight. The film clips add perspective to the soldiers' stories, and the music adds more commentary. Hey, remember Country Joe's anti-war song, 1, 2, 3, What Are We Fighting For? Don't Ask Me, I Don't Give a Damn, Next Stop is Vietnam. Big hit at Woodstock. Well, the modern update we have here is stunning. Just change Vietnam to Afghanistan, then transpose the whole thing into a minor key, and, well, you'll know it when you hear it. As for the 1965 hit Eve of Destruction, we'll hear a punk version, and the collage ends with the original. Also stunning. Today, we'll start off with some movie clips for background, skip ahead to Abu Ghraib, and then catch up with our fighting boys in Helmand Province. If you want to know why we're in Afghanistan, this show is one of the best explanations you'll get. Here is Skidmark Bob's Decade War.
Good evening. Operation Desert Storm rages on.
This is the story of 10 years of the war for hearts and minds.
Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading.
Yo! Saddle up! Lock and load!
All real Americans love the sting of battle.
That's where the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
We like war. We're a warlike people.
War happens and the fighting starts. You know, it's kind of like we're pumped up, motivated, ready to go.
It's the ultimate rush because you know you're going into the fight to begin with. And then you got a good song playing in the background. And that gets you real fired up.
Fire!
Kill! Kill! Kill!
What do you got to be stressed about?
War. Middle East.
You don't listen to the president? We're going to mop the floor with the whole world. The whole world's going to be under our control. So what are you worked up about?
And that is exactly what we are doing. As promised and on schedule. But make no mistake, our commitment in Iraq is changing.
We better get that oil, right? The U.S. Army is not the Peace Corps. The Marines are not the Peace Corps. That's not why we're in Iraq. We're in Iraq for money and oil.
Greed. Power.
Corruption.
Can unleash the dogs of war.
America! Fuck yeah!
We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks.
The only way to win a war is to be just as nasty as the enemy. One thing that worries me is that we're liable to wake up one morning and find out we're even nastier than they are.
Lord, she's a horror. Don't you ever love her more and more?
The number of disturbing photos coming out of Abu Ghraib continues to multiply. The latest picture, obtained by the New Yorker magazine, shows a dead inmate wrapped in cellophane and packed in ice. Another photograph showed an empty room at the Abu Ghraib prison, splattered with blood. On the streets of Baghdad, people are increasingly saying the U.S. occupation is the same as Saddam Hussein's brutal regime. There is no God but God, and America is the enemy of God, hundreds of families chant at the gates of Abu Ghraib.
More and more photographs of the torture victims in Iraq are surfacing all across the globe and in the U.S. mainstream media as the slaughter in Iraq continues at the hands of the U.S. occupiers. A car bomb detonated in Najaf today at the U.S. headquarters, killing 5 Iraqi civilians and 1 U.S. soldier. Another car bomb exploded in Baghdad, killing 2 U.S. soldiers late Wednesday night.
A series of simultaneous bombings in Baghdad.
It's the deadliest attack on U.S. troops in Iraq since the beginning of the war.
Afghanistan. 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates.
stripes, Guantanamo, Rambo 125, put your full metal jacket on, no one here gets out alive.
When they told me I was going to the Korngal Valley, I really didn't read anything up on it. I didn't want to. I wanted to go in there with an open mind. The colonel told me, initially, they take fire every single day. I was like, God, how the hell do you take fire every single day from somebody? You gotta go out there and go kill the damn enemy. Quit being, you know, scared. Go out there and get them. And the colonel and I came up with, you know, what we thought was going to be our campaign plan, and that after 2 months of being there, I would fix it and that we wouldn't get shot at anymore.
The very first date, I remember coming in, and one of the pilots and stuff, and I said, hey, if you look over there to your left, that's the Pakistan, you know, way in, like, you know, we all, okay, that's Pakistan. And then they all mount, you know, high elevation. And as you go in elevation, it starts to get a little bit colder. And then we go up into the Korngal Valley.
I remember looking out the little bubble windows on the side, kind of just like this, because I was right next to the window. And I could see when the Chinook had made a hard right turn into the valley. I was like, holy, we're not ready for this.
I remember getting off the bird and walking up the hill to the hooch.
Hey, don't stand up. You guys standing up right there? You're wrong. Come on, you guys, move.
And just sucking. And thinking, what are we doing?
It started getting dark, and the monkeys were howling. And I thought they were Taliban. And I thought, they're close.
Everybody's like, oh, you're going to the Korngal? Oh, and they feel sorry for you and everything like that. I'm like, dude, it can't be that bad, you know? Show up there, and you're burning your own feces, you know? You're living in a tent. I literally lived in a bunker, you know, about that high. I couldn't even stand up in. See bullet holes all rattled into the HESCOs, and when you look up, it's like, I don't even know why I have HESCOs here, because they're not going to stop the bullets that are coming down from the mountain. So I felt like I was like fish in a barrel.
I'm up here by 0-4, and we're standing. And if we have to, we'll move the contact. I got myself, Regan, and Thomas over here.
Roger.
Hey, I'm about to find this bastard, and I'm going to kill him.
Okay, Roger. So it's coming from 1705 and 00. We should be firing on those here right now. Break.
Hey, hey!
Shots. Right now from 1705, vicinity 2216.
For the first few months of the deployment, we'd get rocked hard. They'd hit us from, they'd ambush us at 360 degrees.
I remember thinking, you know, holy, did everybody from the entire country come to this valley? Is nobody else fighting anymore? Is every bad guy in my face?
The entire country of Afghanistan, we dropped something close to 70% of all the ordnance. All the bombs that were dropped at that particular time were dropped in the Korngal Valley. That CNN dubbed it one day. The boys saw it and said, you know, deadliest place on earth, the Korngal Valley.
Firefight.
Yeah.
Big. Packing up rounds. That was fun, though, man. That was fun. You can't get a better high. It's like crack, you know? You can even skydive or bungee jump or do, you know, kayak, but once you've been shot at, you really can't come down. There's nothing, you can't top that.
A new nation. In 2006, a small number of British troops were flown into a province in southern Afghanistan called Helmand. There were reports that the Taliban had returned to the area and were becoming an increasing threat. British troops were going in to see how real the threat was. The first soldiers were dropped into towns in northern Helmand. In the biggest town, Sangin, they took over a derelict house and turned it into their base. Their job was to find out if there was a Taliban threat in Sangin, and they began to patrol the town.
We did a patrol, and we came across a building, and it had pass-through written on the building, and it actually said Taliban headquarters, which was a bit strange, and we all stood there and thought it was quite funny to have the Taliban headquarters there.
One day I was looking through the binos, looking at somebody in a white dish dash, looking back at me through binos. He had a white turban on, and we were looking at each other, and he was working out his ranges, for obviously for his mortars and everything, for his big attack. And I was looking at him going, this is a bit surreal.
What the Taliban saw was a British army spread thinly. They were exposed and vulnerable, and the Taliban knew it.
It's outside.
Slowly the Taliban let the British know that they were out there. Jason Conway filmed the aftermath of some of the first shots fired.
Where'd it come? Across the top?
You know, like a rifle has a crack and thumb. That's how close it was. You could hear like a crack and thumb.
My arse went then.
The threat was very, very real. The enemy knew that they were in range, so it was just a matter of time.
The Taliban appeared everywhere and began to smash every British base. The men were completely cut off from the outside world. Jason filmed some of the only footage that exists of those early Taliban attacks.
You're fighting on every level. You're fighting for communications, you're fighting for awareness, you're fighting to see the enemy. You are completely focusing in on fighting to your back teeth. You know, it was proper soldiering.
British Army, all pinned down at once, not being able to do a single thing. You've got to ask yourself some questions.
Jason Conway's job was to find where Taliban rockets were coming from and order British mortars and artillery to fire back.
Fire Uniform Quebec 4522 left.
He filmed the damage inflicted by Taliban rockets while men from another regiment had been on the rooftop.
one of them struck that building there. You can see the entrance point. There was three persons killed there. And that was the first fatality within Sangin District Centre.
In the first 3 months in Helmand, 14 British soldiers died, more than had been killed in the previous 5 years of the war. The men were trapped and facing disaster. Things were so bad that in the dead of night, a desperate attempt was made to keep the men alive. They gathered on the rooftop of the house in Sangin, waiting for a plane to drop vital supplies. But when the parachutes finally dropped, it was 2 kilometers away, deep in enemy territory. With nothing to live on and nothing to fight the enemy with, some men were told to prepare for being overrun, captured, and tortured.
Anything with any of our names on, any mail that had got out to us, was destroyed. Any photos we had of our families, we destroyed. Anything with our names on was destroyed, because we were expecting that this wasn't going to come out good. Last night was mad. About 17:30, the boss came up to my position. He told me there was over 1,000 Taliban coming to take our position, wished me luck, and fucked off. There was a lot of Taliban last night. The just kept coming.
British military were left with only one option. A massive bombing campaign driving the Taliban back to save the men's lives.
You know, you're inflicting systematic violence to the extreme to say, you're not going to kill me, I'm going to kill you, because I'm going to put something bigger and harder and nastier on you in order to deter him from coming back and doing it again. Fucking bang on that.
But the bombing also destroyed the homes and lives of the local people of Helmand. And although it created a brief respite, the Taliban were not deterred.
As anyone will tell you that was there, within minutes or within about maybe an hour, someone would pop up from the same position and engage you from now a pile of rubble.
The platoon found themselves under attack from the Taliban just after returning from a patrol.
You're fucking hitting
me. Come on, let's get move on.
Hello, Mum.
Scotty, get your head down.
East Compound 24, rapid!
Level
right.
Fox, 600
metres,
right of
Taunton.
There
goes, yes.
No one here gets it out alive.
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Fighting for. No one here gets it out alive.
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Fighting for.
Fighting for. No one here gets it out alive.
Be a man of stairs. Oh, be a man of stairs. so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
And we end as we began, with Eve of Destruction. That song hit the charts in 1965, and alas, there's no need to change a word today, 48 years later. You'll find the complete version of Decade War and a good deal of interesting music at the blog of Skidmark Bob. And that is popdefectradio.blogspot.com. popdefectradio.blogspot.com. And you'll find a link to them at our own webpage, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust for New World Notes. Illigit to my non-carborundum, and remember, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Ciao.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No shorthand.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
On today's show, you'll hear the first part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that will be followed by some announcements of upcoming events and a new book by David Ray Griffin. Stephen Gowans goes deeper into what motivates the U.S. and its allies to attack and destroy not just Syria, but Iraq and Libya also. I learned some new things from listening to this speech. I think you will too. This is a recent speech he gave in New York City, sponsored by the Hands Off Syria Coalition. And here he is, Stephen Gowans.
Hello. So, this book, I should emphasize this, this book is a book about U.S. foreign policy. That's the principal reason this was written. It's an examination of U.S. foreign policy. What I'll do is I'll summarize the book for you in about 30 seconds. And then I'll elaborate on some of the themes in the book. And then I'll take you through a more detailed look at Washington's long war in Syria, the actual war rather than the book. So let me start with the central idea. The central idea of this book is that the wealthy have, and this is not an unusual idea, it's hardly unique to me, but the wealthy have an inordinate influence on the formation of public policy in the United States, including foreign policy, most especially foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy is structured to promote and defend the interests of billionaire investors and shareholders of U.S. banks and corporations. Washington would like the land, the labor, the resources, the markets of the Arab and Muslim world to be used for the benefit of U.S. bankers, U.S. shareholders of large corporations. By contrast, Syria, under the leadership of Bashar al-Assad, the current president, and before him, his father, the previous president, Hafez al-Assad, wanted the land, labor, resources, and markets of Syria and the larger Arab world to be used for the uplift of Syrians and for the uplift of Arabs. So there's therefore a fundamental contradiction between U.S. foreign policy and the Syrian government. They seek antagonistic goals. This contradiction has been present since at least 1963. 1963 is when the Arab nationalists came to power in Syria. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And the United States has sought to resolve that contradiction in its favor for at least the last six decades. Hence the title of the book, Washington's Long War on Syria. A more fitting title may have been Wall Street's Long War on Syria, which indeed was the working title. And it's the title I wanted, but apparently publishers have some influence over matters like this, so it became Washington's Long War on Syria. Some people, including those who write reviews in Quill and Quire, which reviewed this book recently, and others who are enamored of the work of Noam Chomsky, say that this view is far too simple, that the conflict in Syria is much more complicated than that. But they usually stop there without explaining why they think that view is too simple. Well, let's hear the words of the great docent of the left, Noam Chomsky. What would he say? Chomsky writes in Towards a New Cold War that to understand imperialist wars or interventionist wars, quote, it is a good idea to begin by investigating the domestic social structure. Who sets foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? This is precisely the questions that this book addresses. And the book is organized, or has various sub-themes organized in chapters. So let me take you through what those sub-themes are. The first chapter is titled The Den of Arabism. I really like that phrase, the Den of Arabism. It's not my phrase. And this first chapter is an examination of Arab nationalist ideology, which underlies the actions of the Syrian state and places it in conflict with the interests of Wall Street. That ideology and its hostility to the idea that Washington can and will lead a global order, a global economic order, a global political order, that ideology is best summed up by two phrases, one which comes from the Syrian constitution, the other which comes from the Syrian president. So let me tell you about the phrase that comes from the Syrian constitution. Syria's constitution defines the Syrian state as the beating heart of Arabism and the forefront of confrontation with the Zionist enemy and the bedrock of resistance against colonial hegemony in the Arab world. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has said, quote, Syria is an independent state working for the interests of its people, rather than making the Syrian people work for the interests of the United States. I said that the United States wants to lead a global economic order. That's not a motivation that I've attributed to Washington. In fact, Washington is quite open about this ambition. The phrase, the United States can and will lead a global order, comes directly from the United States 2015 National Security Strategy. It is a fascinating document, and it's readily available on the internet, and I'd recommend that all of you read it if you can. Read it because it's so astonishing. Astonishing because it's a national security document, so you'd expect that it would be about national security. Almost all of it is about economics. Almost all of it is about how to structure the planet economically. And in that national security document, the United States says unabashedly that it can and will lead the world. That it's never a question of whether the United States will lead. That the United States is the world's indispensable power. That it has primacy. That it has a leadership role. That sounds nice when you put it that way. It has a leadership role. It has primacy. The Italian philosopher Domenico Lussardo describes this another way. It says the United States pursues, or there is an international dictatorship of the United States, which is another way of talking about primacy and leading the world. The second chapter of this book is titled Regime Change, and it is an examination of two forces which have worked to bring about regime change in Damascus since the middle 1950s. They've worked sometimes separately, sometimes together. The first force is the United States government under the sway of the U.S. business-owning class. And the second force is the Muslim Brotherhood, the ideological antecedent of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I should hasten to add that it's also the ideological antecedent of more moderate groups, Islamic groups. In Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood is committed to violence as a means of bringing about political change. The Muslim Brotherhood in some other countries is not committed to violence. It's committed to participating in elections. Why the difference? Well, the Muslim Brotherhood's committed to violence in Syria. One of the reasons why is because the Syrian constitution bans political parties based on religion. That means that the Muslim Brotherhood has little recourse but to seek political change through extra-constitutional means and through violence. However, I'll talk later about why it is that there is a prohibition in Syria against political parties based on religion. The Muslim Brotherhood in Syria has worked since the early 1960s to topple the government in Damascus in order to replace it with a Sunni Islamic state. Both the U.S. government and the Muslim Brothers have worked together on efforts of regime change. Chapter 3 is titled The 2011 Distemper. This is a look at whether the uprising, which broke out in 2011, mid-March 2011, whether it was a secular democratic revolt against dictatorship and neoliberalism, as some people argue, and I'll discuss that in more detail in a few moments. Chapter 4 is titled The Myth of the Moderate Rebel, and it is an examination of who the insurgents are, the insurgents that the U.S. government labels as moderates, and what their relationship is to the non-moderate rebels, especially Al-Qaeda. Moderate rebels were defined. The interesting thing about the phrase moderate is that moderate is used to connote rather than denote. It's used to suggest something. Moderation is something good. This was a deliberately constructed phrase of deception. And we know that because if you ever read press reports about the moderate rebels, it might have occurred to you to ask, what is meant by moderate anyway? I know what they want me to think. Moderate, that sounds like pacific, inclined to discussion, perhaps pluralistic. Well, what was really meant was finally revealed by then head of U.S. intelligence, James Clapper, who was talking to the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council on Foreign Relations is kind of a lobby group on behalf of Wall Street. And he said, well, the moderate rebels are any rebels other than ISIS. That's the definition of moderate. Anyone other than ISIS, irrespective of their orientation toward democracy, irrespective of the methods they use, irrespective of their goals or their ideology. They're simply called moderate simply because they were not ISIS. The moderate rebels, in fact, in the main, are Islamists, whose goal is not democracy, but a Sunni Islamic state. They are, in the main, insurgents who use terrorist methods. Not exclusively. They also use other methods of guerrilla warfare, but they also use terrorist methods. And they cooperate on the battlefield with Al-Qaeda. They are enmeshed with Al-Qaeda. They work under license to Al-Qaeda. They are auxiliaries of Al-Qaeda. And they pass their U.S.-supplied weapons to Al-Qaeda. It's fascinating. You don't see it much anymore, but the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Washington Post would talk about U.S.-trained rebels, and they used all kinds of phrases to describe the relationship of those rebels to Al-Qaeda. They said they were enmeshed with them, they were entangled with them, they were cooperating on the battlefield with them, they were sharing weapons with them. Essentially, they were Al-Qaeda, but they're Al-Qaeda under another name. The name was U.S.-supplied and trained moderate rebels. Chapter 5 is titled The Ba'athist Islamic Ally. Ba'athists are the Arab nationalists. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party, and I emphasize socialist because that's part of the explanation for why Free Enterprise Washington is opposed to the Ba'ath Arab Socialists. And there may be some who are raising their eyes and saying, yeah, they might call themselves socialists, but are they really socialists? So, I mean, what is socialism? You can define it in many ways. But the significant question is, does the United States regard them as socialists? And is that one of the reasons why the U.S. government is hostile to the Ba'ath Arab Socialist government of Damascus? And I believe very much it is. And there's no question that the United States regards the government in Damascus as a socialist government. You can read U.S. State Department documents in which complaints are made about the socialist orientation of the government in Damascus. I'll come back to that in a second. The Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party is the party to which Bashar al-Assad belongs. It's also the party to which Saddam of Iraq belonged. The party has three major goals. Unity of the Arab world, so overcoming its religious and other differences, including laying to rest the antagonism between Sunni and Shia. Freedom from foreign domination, it's the second goal. And socialism. Socialism defined as public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy and a significant role for government in the guidance of the economy. The Arab nationalist values of unity, freedom, and socialism also inspired Muammar Gaddafi and were explicitly referred to in the constitution, the first constitution that Gaddafi had written. Gaddafi was greatly impressed by the great Arab nationalist leader, the Egyptian Gamal Abdel Nasser, whose lieutenant he aspired to become. And if you read his constitution, Gaddafi's constitution, which he originally wrote, you'll see explicit references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the Syrian constitutions, the one that was written in 2012, the one written by Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, in 1973, you'll see references to unity, freedom, socialism. If you read the constitution that was prepared for Iraq by Saddam, you'll also see references to unity, freedom, socialism. These values are also implicitly present in the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And it is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the Ba'athist Islamic ally referred to in the chapter title. Now, the political Islam of Iran is non-sectarian. It seeks the unity of the Muslim world and the bridging of differences between Shia and Sunni. It also seeks the freedom of the Muslim world from foreign domination. and it favors an economic model which is largely indistinguishable from the economic model favored by Arab nationalists, namely a model of economic planning and public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy. So many people wonder, you know, why are Iran and Syria allies? Well, they're allies because they want the same things for the most part. But they say, Syria is secular. Iran is Islamic. So how is it that they could be allies? Especially since secular Syria is entangled in a war with Islamists. Well, the Iranians want to overcome sectarian differences in the Muslim world. And the Arab nationalists want to overcome sectarian differences in the Arab part of the Muslim world. The Iranians want to liberate the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Arab nationalists want to liberate the Arab part of the Muslim world from foreign domination. The Iranians favor a significant role for the state in the economy, and the Arab nationalists favor a significant role for the state in the economy. Those are significant reasons why Iran and Syria are allies, despite the fact that one government is secular and the other government is Islamist. Chapter 6 is titled Washington State Islamic Allies, as opposed to its non-state Islamic allies, like Al-Qaeda, for example, or the so-called moderate rebels, most of whom are Islamists. And this is a look at the Islamic countries that are allies of the United States. So if the Islamic State of Iran is an ally of Arab nationalist Syria because they share a commitment to unity and a commitment to freedom from foreign domination and a commitment to socialism, then you might expect that the Islamic allies of Washington would share a commitment to disunity in the Arab and Muslim worlds, a commitment to U.S. hegemony over the Arab and Muslim worlds, and a commitment to free enterprise. And indeed, that would be the case. Washington's principal Islamic State ally, Saudi Arabia, promotes a very divisive brand of Islam, which operates against the efforts of Arab nationalists and the Islamic Republic of Iran to overcome the sectarian differences which divide the Arab and Muslim worlds. The Saudi monarchy is also highly integrated into the U.S. financial elite and depends on the United States for protection against the Saudi population, which is hostile to the monarchy. Chapter 7 is called Divide et Impera, or Latin for divide and rule. I'm not sure why I said Divide et Impera. Maybe I felt Latin that day. And Chapter 8, Echoes of Hitler, look at the efforts of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Muslim Brother's ally, Washington, and Washington's ally, Saudi Arabia, to divide the Arab world on religious grounds. Chapter 7 looks at how the United States restructured Iraq's political system in order to bring sectarian cleavages to the fore. In this time-honored imperialist, you know, tradition of divide and rule, Chapter 8 looks at efforts to paint Arab nationalists in Damascus who seek to bridge the Arab world's religious and other differences, but seek to describe them as an Alawi regime, using Arab nationalism as a cover to pursue a sectarian agenda. We don't see that much anymore, but say in 2016, 2015, there was a lot of writing in the press which would suggest that, as they called it, the Assad regime was an Alawi regime, which was attempting to pursue some kind of sectarian agenda in Syria. There's been this conflation of the Alawi sect with Arab nationalism. It certainly comes from the Muslim Brotherhood to suggest that secular Arab nationalism is simply a cover for the Alawis to pursue their sectarian agenda. Chapter 9 is titled Wall Street's Empire, and it answers the question Chomsky posed as essential to understanding U.S. foreign policy. Who sets U.S. foreign policy? What interests do these people represent? What is the domestic source of their power? So let me just step you through an historical timeline of the conflict in Syria. So this will be a look at the Long War. In the mid-1950s, Washington conspired with London to purge Arab nationalist influence from Syria. Their target was a triumvirate of Arab nationalist and communist leaders who Washington and London perceived as threatening economic interests in the Middle East. Spearheading the effort was Kermit Roosevelt of the infamous Roosevelt family, which gave us two U.S. presidents. Kermit himself was infamous. You may know him as the man who engineered the overthrow of Iran's Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who committed the grave crime against Western domination of nationalizing Iran's oil industry. Roosevelt and British intelligence, MI6, planned to enlist the help of the Muslim Brothers to overthrow the three men in Damascus they saw as threatening Western economic interests. In the 1960s, the Muslim Brothers led protests, strikes, demonstrations, riots in Syria under the banner Islam or Ba'ath, by which they meant Islam or secularism, always in opposition to what the brothers called the government's godless character. In 1967, the Brotherhood declared a holy war against secular nationalists, denouncing them as infidels and enemies of God. In the 1970s, the Brotherhood established an underground paramilitary organization anticipating the so-called rebels of today. The 1970s rebels were armed and trained outside of Syria, just as today's rebels are armed and trained outside of Syria by U.S. and Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan. The Brothers launched a major campaign of urban guerrilla warfare, assassinating Ba'ath Arab socialists, murdering state officials, killing army officers, attacking Syrian government buildings, assaulting Syrian military installations. In 1973, Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father, oversaw the drafting of a constitution for Syria that promulgated a mission for his country. And the mission would be to foster the unity of the Arab world to overcome its religious, sectarian, other differences, in order to achieve the Arab world's liberation from foreign domination and to modernize and indigenize the economy. Modernization and indigenization of the economy would be planned. This is written into the Constitution by economic planning and public ownership, what Washington would denounce as socialism. Indeed, in Washington, Assad was denounced as an Arab communist. He wasn't a communist. In fact, he was suspicious of communists, and communists were suspicious of him. But from Washington's perspective, he may as well have been a communist because the policies he implemented had effects on corporate America equal to the effects of policies that communists would have implemented. In the 1980s, Robert Baer, a CIA officer who'd served in the Middle East for three decades, found that Syria was, quote, the epicenter of Islamic terrorism. Baer wrote, "When I first set foot in Damascus in 1980, I estimated that Assad had maybe 3 or 4 years before he went under. The Muslim Brothers owned the streets. The mosque schools were teaching jihad. The mosque public address system blared out a message of hate and revenge. I figured this guy's going to get strung up on a light pole in downtown Damascus, along with a whole lot of other Syrians." In the 1980s, the Brothers established an Islamic Front for Syria, whose manifesto declared a war without end until Ba'ath Arab socialism was exterminated in Syria. In 1982, the Muslim Brothers seized control of Hama, Syria's fourth largest city. They went on a blood-soaked rampage. They attacked police stations. They murdered any Ba'ath Arab socialist they could find. They executed government officials. They killed soldiers. Every Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party official in the city was executed, many by decapitation. In the Syrian government operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners, including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitaries. Likewise, insurgents operating in Syria today have been trained by the CIA and other Western intelligence services in Qatar and Jordan, as I mentioned. In the 1990s, the Muslim Brotherhood established an alliance with other sectarian or Sunni sectarian Sunni political Islamists to form what became known as the National Front for the Salvation of Syria, but perhaps was more aptly called the National Front for the Salvation of Syria from secularism. The front had two goals, its most pressing and immediate goal was the assassination of Assad. Its longer fundamental goal was to establish an Islamic state in Syria based on the Quran.
You've just been listening to a recent speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst and author Stephen Gowan, speaking about his new book called Washington's Long War on Syria. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that informative speech. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now David Ray Griffin's new book. As many of you know, Dr. David Ray Griffin has written 11 books on 9/11, challenging the official story. And his latest book has just come out. It's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And the first two-thirds of the book are about Bush and Cheney in the aftermath of 9/11. And the last third of the book is about the miracles of 9/11. So again, this book has just been released, and it's called How Bush and Cheney Ruined America and the World. And just as a reminder, 9/11 Wake-Up Call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors and then look for and click on Cheryl under the letter C, and the shows should pop up. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
With Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, the Poor People's Campaign. In December 1967, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. announced a plan to bring together poor people from across the country for a march on Washington to demand jobs, better homes, better education, better lives. Dr. King was in the midst of organizing the Poor People's Campaign when he was assassinated in Memphis, fighting for the economic rights, for the union rights, and for the dignity of the sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968, in tribute to Dr. King to continue his legacy of fighting the three evils of poverty, militarism, and discrimination. The Poor People's Campaign would climax with a Solidarity Day rally for jobs, peace, and freedom on June 19th, 1968. 50,000 people joined the 3,000 participants living at the King-inspired Resurrection City encampment then, set up on the Washington Mall to rally around the demands of the Poor People's Campaign. Today, 50 years later, the Reverend William Barber and a new cadre of activists have picked up the reins of Dr. King's Poor People Campaign in the face of systematic racism and the national government's carefully stoked white supremacy, and in response to the greatest disparity in wealth distribution the world has ever known. In response to, as well, the impending ecological devastation and against militarization used against the world's people.
We're delighted to have with us Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor from the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. He spent a lifetime challenging racism, militarism, and poverty, and whose energies are now committed to building the Poor People's Campaign.
Thank you for joining us. Is the circle unbroken between where you and Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign are today and 50 years back, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King? Is this a circle but an unfinished part of the legacy that Dr. King has handed us?
It was an unfinished line of march. In a sense, this is not a new Poor People's Campaign. It's a Poor People's Campaign of old, and particularly a campaign that we've been engaged in almost since the founding of this country, since it was founded upon exploitation and of people and of lives. And so, again, we're continuing that campaign. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign in the DMV, as well as pastor of Plymouth Church. So we're continuing to do the work, the agitation, trying to lift up the voice, because one thing is clear is that in this historical time, as well as the historical time of 1968, there's a real intolerance that exists. There's a real xenophobia that exists. There's hatred towards those who are others. Right now, we're dealing with immigrants having their children torn out of their arms at the border. Voter suppression, particularly even last Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that Ohio could purge its voting rolls. All of those kinds of things that we are battling to try to uphold. It's been a narrative that we are currently in the midst of that is divisive, that is racist, that is white supremacist. We need to change the narrative, and the only way you really can change the narrative is apply the pressure that you begin to change the narrator.
Reverend Hagler, you've been at a number of protests, both in Washington, D.C. and around the country. You know, you were at one on the Supreme Court last week. You were one on a labor protest for the deadlock workers at Arlington Cemetery. Do you want to pick out a couple of struggles that have been building up to this march on rally to give us a flavor of what's been happening around the country?
Sure. I mean, understand, you know, we've been dealing with water rights. I mean, there was water protectors that trying to keep pipelines from coming through sacred land. And not to mention Flint, Michigan, with the kind of lead and pollutants in the water and the poisoning of people because of the consumption of water. Even in Washington, D.C., dealing with water fees that are being attached to people's bills and people who are least able to pay it are shackled with higher and higher costs because over the years, the government in Washington, D.C. polluted the waters and now it's mandated to clean it up. Nobody's got a problem with cleaning it up, but it's generally how you recoup that money to pay back for it that has basically begun to jeopardize seniors and other poor folks because the bills keep going up. Or a church over in Baltimore that was actually almost foreclosed on because of issues around water cemeteries. And then we're also dealing with the fight for 15, trying to raise up the minimum wage, trying to get to that place where there's really a living wage. You heard me mention the issue around the immigration, kind of draconian things that we're seeing, the kind of merciless things that we're seeing on the border and when it comes to also immigrant community. And we can talk about health care. I mean, these have all been struggles that have battered people on the margins. People who have been poor have battered even those of us who like to think that we're middle class. I always remind folks that we bought into that language of being middle class, but the reality is that many of us are just one paycheck away from being homeless. So we live in and an illusion of what of comfort. So it's these economic issues. And if you remember, one thing that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, he says that an edifice that produces beggars needs to be restructured. And so we really need to look at the kind of economic system that's in place that are continuing to grind up people, keeping people, low-wage workers, very poor, top 1%, basically capturing more than their lion's share of wealth, and all of these kinds of things that are important as we continue to struggle and move forward. And what we're also doing is bringing people together, because very often people operate in their own silos, whether you're talking about LGBTQ issues, whether you're talking about civil rights issues, whether you're talking about the environment. People do the work, and they've done the work very well, but one of the problems has been is that we've operated only in our little territory. And so that has prevented us from amassing the kinds of power that we need to really begin to challenge systems and change the narration and change the structure that continues to batter people.
I want you to continue that theme that you mentioned, that it's systemic. How does one fight a systemic inequity, the history of this country, really, structurally, economically, by changing a moral narrative? How does that give us the intellectual, the spiritual, the political ammunition to restructure an economic system that continues to marginalize and victimize people?
Mm-hmm. First thing is that we got to take our blindfolds off and realize what is taking place around us. I mean, when you talk about poverty, for example, the forces out there have been very clever in trying to, in a sense, make poverty into a racial issue, as if black folks were the only folks that were poor, Latino folks were the only folks that were poor. But in fact, there's more poor whites in this country. One thing that Lyndon Baines Johnson said a long time ago can make the average white person think that they're better off than the average Negro. You can pick the white person's pocket. And that still holds true. We've seen that in this last election. We've seen that over and over again, because what we really have not dealt with very effectively in this country, the issues of racism and white supremacy and the systematic effects of racism and how that affects people not only economically, but in terms of political power. It affects people in terms of having a sense of empowerment within the culture. So we're talking about systemic racism, systemic poverty. So all of this is sort of like really as a part of the system. But the first step is to wake people up to the kinds of contradictions that exist so that people can see themselves reflected in the issue and therefore begin to see themselves reflected in the solution. That's one thing that we're doing in terms of the demonstrations, marching, singing, putting out position papers, and particularly our moral audit that's been put out, is to get people to begin to take off the blindfolds and realize that they're not okay, the country's not okay, and it involves all of us.
We don't usually hear this kind of discussion even on CNN or MSNBC, which tend to resist Trump. We don't get the economic issues coming through. Do you feel that also? Do you feel as if this campaign has been covered adequately?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign has not been covered adequately at all. You know, I just had a meeting with the managing editor of the Washington Post today to raise the issue, because there was two articles, very superficial coverage. Even if you don't want to cover the Poor People's Campaign, cover the kinds of substantive material that has come out of the campaign in terms of the study and the audit. And then people can go and take a look at that by going online to poorpeoplescampaign.org. But it's not being covered. It wasn't covered in this way. You had all the presidential debates, and not one time in the presidential debate did anybody talk about poor folks. Did anybody talk about people on the margins? I mean, they may have talked about against immigration, those types of things, but what they were talking about was tax breaks that really end up being tax breaks for the wealthy and all that other type of stuff. And not once did we really even deal in the political discussion around the economic issues in a substantive way.
What I go back to when I listen to you is W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, when he talks so eloquently about the hows and whys psychologically and actually white overseers in that case identified with when they were in oppressed conditions themselves the issue of white supremacy, because they could always in effect aspire by virtue of their color at least to be the plantation owner. What I'm interested in here is how the Poor People's Campaign begins to take that intractability of white supremacy, which is a good part of what the Trump administration uses to stoke the flames for support for its own policies. How does that become something that is also fought against? How does one begin to make a white working class people and others, it's not just the white working class, not identify with their oppressors by virtue of white supremacy? Where does the Poor People's Campaign fit into that? And that's a really difficult issue.
Well, let me go back, because we really exist in a context of illusion and hoping beyond hope. What I mean by that is that not too long ago, former President Obama did a State of the Union address, and his responder was Jindal out of Louisiana.
Yeah, Bobby Jindal.
I'll never forget what Jindal had to say. He said, "The president would want you to believe that we are a country of haves and have-nots. We Republicans believe that we are a country of haves and those who hope to have." Mm. And he defined it in that statement. It was a clear definition of how the illusion works, so that people, in a sense, hope to have and are hoping and wishing and working on a pipe dream. And, of course, part of that is being a beneficiary of the hope because you're whiteness. And that's a part of what exists. Now, what also that we need to understand is that Trump, he tapped into this whole idea of people and the economic issues and the economic fears. And part of what we're trying to lift up in the Poor People's Campaign is those economic issues, those economic fears, are not being resolved by xenophobia. It's not being resolved by immigrant hatred. It's not being resolved by any of those things, whether somebody kneels for the flag or stands for the flag. It's not being resolved there. But the real issue is can we provide health care for everybody? Can we provide clean drinking water for everybody? Kinds of economic foundation that allow people to really actually thrive. And so as long as we exist in that issue of delusion, there will be people who will not look and will not come over. But on the other hand, there are people who, once their eyes are open, they come over. And one of the things that's been going on is that we have stereotyped the faith community in that somehow the only people that are considered by commercial media as part of the religious community are those on the evangelical right. Well, the reality is that there's far more people who have been elsewhere, been doing things around immigrants, around employment, housing, all of that, that are also part of faith community, but one, never get covered, and two, has not really been activated until now. They're in every single community. They are white, they are black, they're Latino, they're Jewish, they're Muslim, they're Native people, everybody coming from different places. And basically to tap in and to activate that community is to get to that constituency that you're talking about, but it's also, in a sense, to elevate the voices of faithfulness, the voices of justice.
So, Reverend Hagler, tell us more about this demonstration, this rally, this march on Saturday the 23rd, and what's the strategy after that?
Well, it is bringing folks together from our various campaigns that have been taking place around the country. A great speak out, a great demonstration, where we're able to see the length and the breadth of the movement that has existed in 40 different states in the District of Columbia. And in that, to draw strength, draw empowerment, to realize that we are not alone, that everybody who've been operating in their states have been operating in concert, people that they knew were there, but people that they have not seen, people from the faith community, from all walks of life. It'll be people from different communities, people who don't necessarily have faith, but are people of conscience and believe in some things. So in that, I would say that they have faith too. So to come together and the statement that we're making on the 23rd is that even though we have gone through these 40 days, this is not the end. This is a statement. This is the inauguration of the campaign that's going to continue. And all of the state and local apparatus that have been built will go back and get to work and do all that they have been doing and do more in order to begin continue to challenge the system, because what we've done and what we are doing is building a whole fabric of networks out there. And clearly we're saying that we're going on, we're going forward, we're going to make a change.
This phenomenal activity, which isn't the culmination, it's just beginning to pick up steam, the Poor People's Campaign. But one of the things that Reverend Barber said that I thought was most critical is it's not about a fight against Trump, as detestable as he may be personally in my thoughts, but it is against the Trumpian policies. There's been lots of evidence now that it really wasn't just the economic insecurities of white people that promoted Trump. It was the fundamental strain that courses through the bloodstream of this country, which is the strain of white supremacy. So when Ken asked how you see proceeding, indeed, how do we proceed with those things? And how does the Poor People's Campaign take up the issues, which is an ongoing struggle? How does it continue? How do we get involved from here on out? And, of course, everybody will after the 23rd, without a doubt.
And I think that, you know, everybody, the state apparatuses, so they need to get into the state apparatus. You can, like I said, you can go to poorpeoplescampaign.org and find out where and who is operating in your area if you're not yet a part of it. Number two is one of the weaknesses have been is that we have reacted to those who have or we perceived as being in power. This is a matter of building our own action, our own power, not as a reaction to, but as an action for. Build it, because we can talk about Trump all we want, but the reality is if Trump was gone tomorrow, the conditions would still exist around health care, around water, around voting rights. So all those issues would still exist. They would not have gone anywhere. So in a sense, you know, there is that whole ideology that exists out there that Trump has rode to power. And so we got to continue to struggle against those and make a big difference by not reacting, but acting and building and bringing people in and lifting up the voices that need to be lifted up, particularly the voices of those who have been impacted.
And I have to say, with people like yourself who have been involved for decades and decades in the challenges to racism, to militarism, to poverty, you've been picking up the thread. Indeed, you were part of that thread all these many years that was the Poor People's Campaign. And so this time, we're carrying it forward with your leadership, with the Reverend Barber's leadership, and the leadership of the people. We need less charismatic leaders and more charismatic movements, and I think the Poor People's Campaign is on the verge.
And let's not forget Reverend Liz Theo Harris, who has been the co-chair there along with Reverend Barber.
We not only won't forget, we are excited. We make it every one of the states and a truly national Poor People's Campaign, a people's movement for people's empowerment. Reverend Graylin Hagler, thank you for your decades of work, for speaking us to us.
Great, and thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And we are going to hear the final words from the Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach, an author, preacher, and professor. He is the chief architect of the Forward Together Moral Monday movement and the Poor People's Campaign. Let's listen.
We need a fresh wind. Language and vision or illumination and fire are important, but the text says the first thing that happened was the wind. We need a new moral fusion movement blowing in every community across this land. Same folk who are attacking public schools, attack health care, the same ones do that, attack the LGBT community, the same ones that do that, attack labor, attack Muslims, attack the immigrants, attack voting rights, attack living wages. And if they're cynical enough to blow a foul wind, then we have to be courageous and yielded enough to be a part of a fresh win. Because America needs more than a strategy to win back some seats for Democrats in 2018. We need a new moral Pentecostal wind that begins to blow against racism and poverty and the war economy. We need a wind that will blow us right out of this chapel, right down south, right in the Rust Belt, right in the Wheat Belt, and even in the places of New York that some people feel are off limits. We need the kind of wind that blew them out of that upper room, and they were no longer afraid of that Caesar who loved to build towers. They were no longer afraid of that Herod who built and put his money on the faces of the corn. And I'm convinced that some of what we're seeing is the last gasp of an order that is passing away. Pentecost in Acts tells us that 2,000 years ago, people were impressed by folks speaking in other tongues that weren't their own. Tongues got the ears' attention. The fire caught the eyes' attention. But the real miracle of that day was the wind blew people together that otherwise would be torn apart. One writer says to us in this moment, he says, the combination of economic anxiety, the insatiable greed of the Koch brothers and their ilk, and a barely subliminal racism against a black man serving in our country as president set the stage for what we see now. And then Donald Trump appropriated much of Sanders' rhetoric about Wall Street, bankers, billionaires, and the globalized economy. He added his own Trumpian vitriol against immigrants, African Americans, Muslims, gangs, drug dealers, and women. And to many people, they bought the con. But history shows that just getting rid of Trump will not fix everything that has gone wrong. Focusing on his obvious personality disorders may be entertaining, but it's not a winning strategy. This is a historical moment of realignments and transformations here and around the world. There's a foul wind, and Donald Trump is merely a symptom. And so we need a fresh wind. One of the first ways we be a part of a fresh wind is when a few weeks ago we announced the Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America since the Poor People's Campaign's challenge on racism, poverty, war, and national morality. You don't pass the 50th anniversary of a prophet's death without evaluating what the prophet stood for, where you are and where you aren't. And once you figure out where you aren't, the only way you can honor the prophet is to pick up from there and move forward. We are praying that this audit will begin to blow a fresh wind. We've got economists and poor people and historians and preachers and clergy sitting on this panel doing seriously. Where are we? What? Not in the last 4 years, but in the last 50 years. Not Democrat or Republican, but let's examine the very foundations and the factors that have impacted America on what should be our deepest moral concerns: economic sustainability and poverty, health care, education, environmental justice, women's rights, criminal justice reform, the proliferation of guns, voting rights, immigrant justice, not just immigrant rights, immigrant justice. Where are we? And then, because we can't just have a piece of an audit, we've got to have a movement. And so we believe in this moment we've got to not just keep the focus on Trump, but we've got to focus on how do we challenge these systems that create these symptoms. And so we must have a revival, a reimagination, an implementation of the Poor People's Campaign. We can no longer just go and have memorials and commemoration services. That's not how you honor prophets and prophetic movements. We must resurrect and embrace the vision. And we need a new Poor People's Campaign made up of clergy and poor people and artists and academics and people of every race and every gender to come together. And we need a season of resistance, not intermittent marches, but a season of resistance. What would happen if we had 40 days, let's just say in 2018? What about starting on Mother's Day, 40 days? And what if we had clergy, Jewish and Muslim and imams and poor people leading groups of 25 or 50 into state capitals, and then groups of 100 going straight into the Capitol, not only outside in Washington, D.C., but right over to Ryan's office and right over to McConnell's office. And if we had an agenda out of this audit, and what if we began to sit down and every day they had to arrest us for 40 days? And what if we took a part of the poor people's campaign, but where they went to D.C. and set up camp, what if we set up camp in 25 states and camp in the District of Columbia? And what if Union had three of those days where the president and students and others would lead something into the Capitol in Ryan? What if every seminary across the country holding hand with poor people and people without health care and immigrants? I mean, what if... Yeah, Dr. King had us on the way, had us in the way. The system killed him on the way, and now it's time for us to find a way. We need to find a way to finish. Somebody said, well, what difference will it do? Well, I know one thing. If that many people get arrested for that many days, it's going to at least change the narrative. First, you have to have moral imagination, prophetic imagination, and then you get prophetic implementation, and so we need it, and so we're committed, and I hope you will join us. You can go to breachrepairers.org and begin to sign up, but we've got to build a movement that has some wind, that has some ruach, that began to shake the foundations of this nation. That's bigger than one president, but it's about principle. It's about changing the trajectory of the nation. It's not just a Democratic wind or a Republican wind or independent wind, but a moral wind. And I believe it's time. Right now, to 218, if we do it right, we'll birth a movement that'll last another 15 or 20 years. We have to do it. We've got to have this new tongue and new fire, and we've got to have a movement that puts a new wind beneath the knee. What if for just 40 days, everybody could stay in their silos? You know, Black Lives Matter could do their thing, women could do their thing, environmentalists could do their thing for the other 325 days. But for 40 days, we decide to walk together, children, huh? And decide to not be weary. You know, I think we can do it. Not because I just am, you know, an optimist. I am hopeful. I don't have to walk by faith altogether on this. I can walk by sight. Every major social movement in this nation that's ever been won is because somebody came together and created a new wind. I feel a wind blowing. It's going to blow down south. It's going to blow all over America. We are not going to let the prophet's dream die. It's to... There's a new wind blowing.
The Reverend William Barber.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Gemma.
played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep-sea diver in the Navy. And he finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer historian Lillian Faderman milks the unknown Harvey. Poland's top court rejects a printer's refusal to make LGBT banners, and Tony winners rally for the resistance. Those stories and more this week, because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 16, 2018. Poland's Supreme Court ruled this week that a print shop employee violated the principle of equality before the law when he refused to make banners for the LGBT business forum because he didn't want to promote gay rights. The nation's top court upheld a lower court decision that the printer did not have the right to withhold services based on sexual orientation or other personal characteristics. Poland's Justice Minister and Attorney General, Zbigniew Ziobro of the ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party, brought the appeal. He angrily told reporters that the justices had served the ideology of homosexual activists. Many people, especially in the U.S., were quick to draw comparisons to last week's ruling by America's Supreme Court that upheld a Colorado baker's right, on narrow religious grounds, to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Yaroslav Yaruga, a lawyer with the Helsinki Foundation for Human Rights, sees some similarities. But he noted that religious belief was not a specific factor in the Polish High Court decision. He said that while ruling that sexual orientation can't be the basis for refusal of service, the justices also said that there can be exceptions based on the nature of the service being rendered. Sometimes freedom of conscience and religion will be a legitimate reason for the refusal to perform the service, Yaruga explained, and at other times may constitute a manifestation of unauthorized discrimination.
Yet another U.S. federal court continues to deny President Trump's attempted ban on military service by qualified transgender enlistees from taking effect. Judge Marsha Peckman of the U.S. District Court for the Western District of the State of Washington issued a preliminary injunction against the ban in December and on June 15th denied the Trump administration's request to lift it. She said that the administration had not shown that it would suffer irreparable harm if the ban remained blocked, but that current and aspiring transgender service members would be hurt if it went into effect. The status quo shall remain, steady as she goes, she wrote, and the preliminary injunction shall remain in full force and effect nationwide. Three other federal judges around the country have also blocked the ban from becoming a reality.
June's LGBTQ Pride Month is in full swing around the world. St. Croix and the U.S. Virgin Islands celebrated Pride for the first time on June 9th, despite anonymous social media threats that participants would be gunned down en masse. Local police and agents in the FBI field office in San Juan, Puerto Rico, are reportedly investigating the threats. Anti-queer protesters who were far outnumbered by Pride marchers were kept at bay by a strong police presence. Police Chief Winsbutt McFarland told local media that, at the end of the day, these individuals pay taxes, work in our community, and are members of our community. And because of that, my obligation is to the safety of this community, and that's what we did today. The Advocate spotted a few dignitaries in the crowd, including the territory's delegate to Congress, Stacey Plaskett, and gubernatorial candidate Albert Bryan. Bryan said that people in the Caribbean, many of whom are of African descent, should be able to relate to the fight for LGBT rights. He told the Virgin Islands Consortium that 67 years ago, we were the ones who were hosed when we were marching. So we have to realize that in this world, people have a right to be who they are.
Organizers said that 500,000 people attended Rome's annual Pride celebration on June 9th. With the theme of Rainbow Brigade Liberation Continues, marchers demanded that civil marriage replace the currently available but inferior civil unions and protested the denial of adoption rights to those couples.
Thousands also celebrated Pride on June 9th in two countries that are considered to be less than friendly to LGBTQ rights. According to the Associated Press, a party-like atmosphere prevailed in Warsaw as people waved rainbow flags and danced.
A festive mood also characterized the Pride parade in the Romanian capital of Bucharest. Activists there were especially celebrating the recent European Court of Justice ruling on behalf of a Romanian gay man and his American-born husband that requires all member states to grant residency to same-gender spouses, even if the country itself, like Romania, doesn't offer civil marriage to its own lesbian and gay couples.
China's largest city, Shanghai, celebrated its 10th year of Pride on June 9th. According to a report in Time magazine, more than 40 individual events began with a three-mile fun run and included a pink brunch, a film festival, and a trivia night. China's communist government has not been consistent in its treatment of LGBTQ people or issues, allowing some queer cultural events to go on while censoring or shutting down others, most recently some popular queer-focused web sites. Brian Song, who helped organize Shanghai Pride's The Journey of Light Choir concert that featured English and Chinese songs performed by seven LGBT-friendly choirs from across the country, told Time that, "We were a little bit worried that maybe our concert would get canceled because of the current environment regarding LGBT in the media."
A phobic Christian minister in Anchorage, Alaska, failed miserably in his effort to preach at what has become an increasingly popular new wrinkle on Pride celebrations. Pastor Dave Grisham of Last Frontier Evangelism posted video of himself bursting into the Luzac Public Library during a private drag queen story hour. It was an official event during Anchorage's Pride Fest celebration. His unscheduled appearance didn't go over well with the children or their parents.
Pretends he can't hear their words over the swish, 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 crinkle, 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 and click, click, click he makes when he walks.
Hey kids, my name is Pastor David, and I wanted to tell you today that there is no such thing as there's no such thing as transgenders. Transgenders do not exist. They do not exist. God made men women, men and women women.
You do not have a ticket, sir. You do not have a ticket. You are being disruptive. You do not have the right.
Grisham is well known in the Anchorage area for disrupting queer positive events. He's even tried his homophobic and transphobic preaching at LGBT Christmas parties where children were present.
Queer fans who plan to go to football's World Cup in Moscow this week were repeatedly warned to keep a low profile. Anti-queer violence has more than doubled in Vladimir Putin's Russia since he signed a law in 2013 making the dissemination of gay propaganda to minors a crime. And his government has denied numerous credible reports of a brutally murderous anti-queer purge in Chechnya, claiming that there are no LGBT people at all in that mostly Muslim region of the country. Social media has been filled with threats by thugs to attack any perceived to be queer fans at the World Cup. Members of the Cossack militia announced that they'd be patrolling a number of the games to help police prevent gay men from kissing. The first reports of homophobic violence came on opening day. A gay couple who had traveled from France to cheer on their national team was targeted and attacked in St. Petersburg after they caught a taxi. One of the men, identified only as O. Davrius, was hospitalized after the assault with severe brain trauma and a fractured jaw. His partner, who wasn't named, was less seriously injured. They were also robbed of their money and cell phones. Two suspects are reportedly already in custody.
But finally,
I dedicate this award to the countless LGBTQ people who have fought and died for the right to live and love as we are created to.
That's Andrew Garfield accepting the Best Lead Actor in a Play trophy at the annual Tony Awards on June 10th for his performance as Prior Walter in the Broadway revival of Tony Kushner's Angels in America. The multi-talented Nathan Lane took home the award for Best Featured Actor in a Play for his role as slimy, closeted gay lawyer Roy Cohn in Angels, and Tony Kushner himself accepted the Tony for Best Revival of a Play. For each of them, the personal was also political.
I want to thank Tony Kushner for being such an adorable genius. Even his emails are Pulitzer worthy. I'm standing here because Tony wrote one of the greatest plays of the 20th century, and it is still speaking to us as powerfully as ever in the midst of such political insanity. I want to send my thanks and love, most importantly, to my to my dear husband, Devlin Elliott, the greatest blessing in my life. Thank you very much.
21 weeks till November 6th, the midterm elections. 21 weeks to make sure that the right of citizens to vote is protected and exercised. 21 weeks to save our democracy and heal our country and heal our planet. And then, what kind of a homosexual would I be if I didn't say, it's June 10th, happy birthday, Judy Garland. Bye.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 16th, 2018, written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
He's a rebel and he'll never ever be any good. He's a rebel and he never ever does what he should.
Just because he doesn't do what everybody else does.
That's the reason why we can't share our love. He is always good to me. Good to him, I'll try to be. Cause he's my rebel and I know that up. He's my rebel and I know that up to me.
Charismatic, eloquent, a wit, and a smart aleck. That's how Lillian Faderman describes one queer icon in her latest book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. Those same words could be said of Faderman herself, who's a queer icon in her own right. The renowned LGBTQ historian talked about how she created a different kind of biography of Milk with Ralph Radabaugh and Rita Gonzalez of the KPFK Los Angeles podcast, The Out Agenda.
Lillian, besides the obvious, why Harvey Milk now, and why Harvey Milk at all? I mean, yes, he's a gay icon, incredibly interesting person, but what is it that inspired you to want to write a book about him?
I did a book called The Gay Revolution that came out in 2015, and I did a lot of research and interviews on Harvey for that book, and it's a huge book. It's an 800-page book, but I cover a period from 1948 to 2015. I finished just before it went to press. And, of course, I could only spend about maybe 15 pages on Harvey there. But I had discovered such interesting material that nobody had dealt with before. Randy Schiltz wrote a wonderful book about Harvey in 1982, the mayor of Castro Street. But the material that I found wasn't available to him. And Yale University Press came to me after the Gay Revolution, my 2015 book, came out, and asked if I would be interested in doing a book on Harvey for their series called Jewish Lives. And, of course, it took me about 10 seconds to say yes. I had just come to admire him. And to see him for the person he was, and he was in many ways very flawed. He had a lot of warts, as I discovered, but he was also so heroic, and I think I can say that I really came to love him. There was a documentary about his life, of course, the movie Milk in 2008, and he had been, I think, more honored than any gay person. He received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. There was a stamp with his image on it that was issued. There's going to be a ship named after him. It will be the U.S. Navy ship Harvey Milk.
Well, he was kind of interesting, too, in the fact that he didn't start out as an activist. I mean, he was born in New York, came to California, landed in San Francisco in Castro Street, and opened up a camera shop.
Yeah, he was a chameleon in the true sense of the word. He was an opera lover, even as a kid. He discovered opera at the age of 11. But he became a jock in high school and in college, too, maybe to to hide that secret passion that he feared would somehow associate him with things effete. And so he played every single sport. He played football and baseball and basketball. He did wrestling. He ran track. He played soccer. In college, he even wrote for 3 years for the college newspaper as their sports columnist. Then he went into the Navy, and he was a deep-sea diver in the Navy, and he came out, didn't know what he wanted to do, but he had a credential from college, and so he taught high school for 1 year. He was really unhappy doing that. He and his lover at the time went to Dallas, Texas, where he sold sewing machines. He was unhappy doing that. He came back. He finally got a job on Wall Street as a securities analyst. It's not the Harvey Milk that we know.
No.
And he got involved with someone who was in the theater, who was very much a hippie during the 1960s, and Harvey became a hippie, grew his hair long, became a real advocate of pot smoking, dressed in denim and had a huge mustache, looked very much like a radical in the 1960s, moved to San Francisco with his then lover. They didn't know how they would make a living, and the story is that they sent some film out to be developed at a store in the Castro, and it came back with all of the pictures virtually destroyed. And Harvey said to his lover, Scott Smith, we should open a camera store where we'll take good care of people's film. They didn't sell cameras. They couldn't afford it because they didn't have much money, but they developed film. They rented projectors. They had camera equipment, but very few cameras. They sold a few very inexpensive cameras. And in 1973, it was really a turning point in Harvey's life because the Watergate hearings happened, and he just absolutely hated Richard Nixon, but he watched the hearings faithfully. He hated John Mitchell. He hated John Dean. And he thought at that point, politics is really corrupt. Someone has to get into politics who will do it right, not the way Nixon and his team did it. He ran for office the first time in 1973. But, you know, he was complex even in his personality. For instance, he wasn't just on the board of supervisors to promote gay rights. He was very interested in promoting the rights of senior citizens. He was really interested in things like rent control, for instance. He was very interested in making coalitions with ethnic and racial minorities. He was very interested in helping young people and in the rights of young people. He was wonderful with people much of the time. I interviewed so many people who knew Harvey personally and who told me that when he talked to them, he made them feel as though whatever they were saying was the most important thing to be listening to at that time. And yet, with his lovers, he could be so explosive, really sort of insensitive. He loved them. I found love notes that would really tear at anyone's heartstrings that he wrote to his lovers. And yet, he didn't give them attention when they absolutely needed and craved his attention. He was too busy being a politician. And yet here was this guy who just absolutely loved humanity without a doubt. So that was a huge contradiction. I think he was really sincere in what he believed politically, and I think that drove him to become a politician.
If I'm fighting for gay rights, then either I'm a hypocrite or I have to fight for the rights of everybody. And once I fight for the rights of everybody, then I have to fight for the spending priorities of everybody, or I'm a hypocrite. And I don't think I'm a hypocrite, and that's why I've been involved in the issues of the district for so long, so hard. ¶¶
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba. We are speaking with Lillian Faderman on her new book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death. How did you get all this other information on him?
Well, I did some interviews with family members who told me a lot about Harvey's family, and I write about that much more extensively than had been written about before. I start with the patriarch of the family. His grandfather came from Lithuania and was a peddler for a while, and it's just an incredible success story, so I start with that. I found letters that were not available when Randy Schiltz was writing the mayor of Castro Street, letters that were actually written to a young woman in Los Angeles. Harvey lived in Los Angeles for just a few months, but made friends with a young woman who became his confidant from 1955 to the early 1960s. And those letters were so revealing to me because Harvey told her so much of his personal life and his personal thoughts, and they had nothing to do with politics. They just had a lot to do with his romantic feelings. He had fallen in love with a young man by the name of Joe Campbell, and he was just so incredibly romantic in those letters to Susan Davis. Susan Davis Altsch, she was eventually called because she got married. At one point, Harvey was just so restless because he didn't know what he wanted to do with his life, and he spills that part of his life out to Susan Davis. So it was just a whole view of him that nobody had talked about before. I also discovered letters and notes that he wrote to the guy who was actually the director of Hair on Broadway and Jesus Christ Superstar, a man by the name of Tom O'Horgan. He and Tom O'Horgan became very good friends. And Tom was a correspondent even when Harvey moved to San Francisco. And when Harvey was finally elected to the Board of Supervisors, he wrote these wonderful notes to Tom O'Horgan that really gave another insight into him, just his great pride in having been elected. And he wrote to Tom about how he was going to have a banquet celebrating his election, and Mervyn Dimely, who was the lieutenant governor of California, would be a speaker at the banquet. And he said something to the effect of, who would believe that this faggot would have a banquet in his honor in which the lieutenant governor would give a speech. And then he invited Tom O'Horgan to come to the banquet. He was invited by the San Diego Opera to sit in a VIP box to watch an opera singer that Harvey very much admired, who was already 68 years old, and Harvey had seen him when he was a kid at the Metropolitan Opera, where he was standing in the standing room. And he wrote to Tom O'Horgan about that experience, which was so exciting to him. He talked about sitting next to another famous opera singer in this VIP box, and he said to Tom O'Horgan, oh, life can be so wonderful. And I found that note so moving because it was actually written 2 days before his assassination.
It's amazing to have these letters that people had. I mean, nowadays people don't even do letters. It's just,
I know. I worry so much about
it. I do, too. I was thinking about that right now. I said, because that's how you found out about people, who they were by their letters, not emails.
Right. I don't know what future historians are going to do, because so much of these great archives where I've done so much of my work, the collections are mostly letters. And what's going to happen when there aren't letters like that?
Lillian, is there any chance that you have a short little passage from the book that you'd like to read?
Yes, I would be happy to do that. Yeah. Should I read from the introduction? Is that
sure, if that's what you'd like to read from.
Okay. Harvey Milk, charismatic, eloquent, a wit and a smart aleck, was one of the first openly gay men to be elected to any political office anywhere. On November 18, 1977, soon after he won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, he made three tape recordings that he distributed to close friends to be played only in the event of my death by assassination, he instructed at the beginning of each tape. Though he did not keep it a secret from associates that he had made the tapes, when his irreverent young City Hall intern, Cleve Jones, learned of them, he teased Harvey, "Hey, you're not Martin Luther King. You're not important enough." Harvey was shot to death 1 year and 9 days later by Dan White, a fellow supervisor who had complained that San Francisco was being turned into Sodom by men who would not hide their homosexuality, and that Harvey Milk was in the forefront of the city's abhorrent transformation. The words Harvey dictated into his tape recorder would have sounded foolishly melodramatic had he died a natural death, but with his murder, they took on the weight of prophecy. "If a bullet should enter my brain," he had said on the tape he made for his friend Frank Robinson, "let that bullet destroy every closet door."
I'm Rita Gonzalez, along with Ralph Radaba.
Our guest has been
Lillian Faderman with her book, Harvey Milk, His Lives and Death.
Every gay person must come out. As difficult as it is, you must tell your immediate family, you must tell your relatives, you must tell your friends if indeed they are your friends, you must tell your neighbors, you must tell the people you work with, you must tell the people in the stores you shop in, and once you do, you will feel so much better.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Jessica Andrea and Michael LeBeau, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, and from Rita Gonzalez and Ralph Radaba. Buena Vista performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 4NSA Noosa, Queensland, WJSC Johnson, Vermont, KOOP Austin, Texas, and on more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The history of New York City is one of near constant rebellion. As my guest today writes, it's almost as if social peace is the exception, a small island of calm in an always churning sea. Yet most chronicles of the city paper over that history. To set the record straight, Don Mitchell has edited, with the late Neil Smith and a fleet of contributors, a fascinating historical geography of upheaval in that metropolis. It's called Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City, and it's published by the University of Georgia Press. Mitchell is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden and professor emeritus at Syracuse University. Don, New York represents both the pinnacle of wealth and power in the U.S., but less remembered, as you're arguing, near constant resistance to that power and wealth. How has disorder been as much a part of New York's history as social order?
That's actually a very interesting set of questions, because I don't think you can separate them. I think they're intertwined with each other. And what we discovered when we were working on this book was that moments of unrest are always leading to moments of kind of the reassertion of an order. And sometimes that order is changed, it's transformed in certain ways, but order always reasserts itself, which then sets the stage for kind of the next round of tumult and upset. So I think trying to understand the city as something of a dialectic between order and disorder is a very helpful way of understanding it. And yet much of the work has been more on the side of, you know, the construction of the order of New York City. And so it's been for us quite enlightening to learn just how central moments of riot and other kinds of unrest have been in the making of the city as we know it.
Right, and you argue that places are
produced, actively produced from all that tumult and revolt and counter-revolt, or the reaction that happens following the revolt. And so this is an intrinsic part of understanding how the city came to be what it is. You also argue that moments of revolt, as well as very much the reaction that they inevitably bring down upon them, illuminate the geography of power in this city, whether it's based on class or race or ethnicity. Can you tell us exactly what you mean by that?
Sure. One of the ways that we frame our argument in the book is through an argument by Alan Locke, who's often called the Dean of the Harlem Renaissance. And after the 1935 Harlem riot, he argued that riots were like lightning flashes that illuminate the structure of the city. And I think he's really right about that, that those moments of unrest show what the power structure looks like, shows who's in control and how tenuous their control might be, who the order serves and to what end, what purpose that might be. But it also shows the ways in which any time that there is, whatever that city structure is, if we're thinking about it sociologically or geographically, whatever that structure is, when there's a moment of unrest, of riot or of rebellion, then all of a sudden the ways in which the kind of hidden ways in which power works within the city become exposed, either through the reaction of the authorities or through rioters and activists and others themselves, who quite often after the fact are able to show what it is led to this moment of unrest and what it is about the ways in which those in power wield their power or sometimes fail to wield their power, that kind of shapes everyday life without us paying that much attention to it.
Is there any danger in focusing, though, in these moments of rupture, which, although you're arguing that in the history of New York City that there's been near continuous rebellion, but of course, it's not necessarily happening every single day. So there are more days, more times when people are not actively revolting than when they are. And is there any danger on focusing on those more exceptional moments?
Oh, absolutely. And so we try and make the argument at both at the beginning and the end of the book that there's a real danger in both the way we wrote the book and in anyone reading the book of placing way too much weight on these moments and losing sight of all of the organizing and other activities that go into making a moment of unrest possible or recovering from it. Because even those who are right in the middle of it, who might be the most benefited from a moment of rebellion, don't always know what they're doing at a particular moment. But the ground has always been prepared in some way or another. And so the way this really came home to me was I was trying to write the afterword to the book, and it was early February of 2017, right when Trump announced the Muslim ban. And everybody flooded to airports around the United States, but particularly in New York City, to JFK. It was a quite remarkable moment of unrest in many ways, of resistance. And the New York Times, quoting Michael Moore, say that this protest at JFK Airport came out of nowhere. And that's absolutely wrong. It, of course, came out of 400 years of history, as we argue, but more immediately, it came out of years and years and years of organizing by immigrant rights groups, anti-racist groups, and so many others who were ready to respond instantaneously when something like this happened. And so we were able to trace it most directly to the 2006 immigrant rights protests. But there's a really much longer history than that. So there's a real danger of overlooking that kind of lesser seen politics. And so we point to that, but we also wanted to make the point at the same time that we can't ignore these moments of unrest, as many histories do.
And one of the things that you do by looking at the moments of revolt and riot is you examine the ways that these moments, which often when they're happening are bemoaned by people, including those who might be sympathetic to the cause of the people revolting, who wring their hands and say, well, this is terrible. People are burning down the places that they live, that there will be terrible consequences to this, and nothing will be gained from these moments. But you and your fellow authors in this book, Revolting New York, argue that actually these moments produce all sorts of outcomes, some which may indeed be negative, that is the crackdowns from the powers that be, but also actually often force tremendous change.
That's true. And I don't think any of that, you know, what the outcome of any kind of moment of unrest is going to be is entirely predictable in advance. And certainly not in the short term and not necessarily over the long term. So if you think about the 1977 blackout, when, you know, the city just burst into flames almost instantaneously, this giant kind of upwelling of really inchoate anger on people's behalf when the lights went off. And you know, this massive wave of arson, which fit into a longer wave of arson that was hitting the city at the time, this massive wave of arson, of looting, and so on and so forth, which destroyed whole neighborhoods. And often, as you were just saying, the neighborhoods in which the people who were themselves directly involved in it lived. And there is really no... It's hard to make sense of that moment. It's very hard to make sense of that moment. Except as this moment of just kind of pure rage and then the opportunity to express it. But the long-term outcomes of that were many, some quite awful, transformations in policing, for example, that led to a deepening of the racist practices of policing, I think. Some of them much longer terms in and but more positive, including this kind of shocking this shock of recognition by city authorities, middle class people, and many, many others that things were just totally messed up on the streets and in the neighborhoods of New York City. And therefore, a lot of energy towards reform and transformation. And then also in the long term, the riots themselves is kind of the low point in New York City's disinvestment in the 1970s, prepared the ground in many ways and in quite unpredictable ways for New York's total hyper-gentrification. And so ground zero of the rioting during the 1977 blackout was Bushwick, which then becomes the real center of gentrification by the first decade of the 2000s. So that's just one example, and we can see that across the whole history of New York City.
Indeed, and I'd like to ask you about some of that history. Starting with the 17th century uprisings by the Muncie against the Dutch occupation of Manhattan, what were the circumstances of the occupation, and what did the revolt lead to, a key moment in the production of the place that we now think of as New York City?
So all through the 1630s and 1640s, there were ongoing skirmishes between the Dutch authorities and settlers in colonialists in what's now Lower Manhattan, New Amsterdam at the time, and various indigenous groups who were resident on Manhattan Island itself or across what's now the Hudson River, the North River, as it was called by the Dutch colonists at the time, in what's now New Jersey, or those who live in what's now Staten Island. There were just these constant skirmishes over territory, over land, over loss of livelihoods, over hunting privileges, over disagreements about what was really bought from Native Americans at different times, whether it was the land itself or just rights to use the land, and all those sorts of things. And there's this constant skirmishes, as well as massacres by people on both sides. And it was a quite bloody time in New Amsterdam. And during some of those massacres, the violence was just extraordinary, certainly to our kind of contemporary senses of whole villages of Native Americans being wiped out with all the children being killed, and then retaliatory attacks by the Muncie and other Native groups on Dutch colonists around a whole set of different issues. And the immediate kind of cause of what we call the Revolt of the Muncies in the 1640s were a series of abrogations of what Muncie natives thought were a set of agreements about how the land was to be used between the incoming settlers and themselves, as well as rumors of rape, of other deprivations. And with that, then, there was just a series of ongoing raids, basically, between native groups and then colonists and the militias and so forth, fighting back and vice versa. The end result of all of those was that the tenuousness of New Amsterdam as a Dutch colony became even more tenuous. And it became an enormously expensive colony for the Dutch to maintain and to defend, and in many ways therefore paved the way to the transfer of New Amsterdam to the British in 20 years later, basically.
I'm speaking with Don Mitchell, who is co-editor of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So after the region was passed over to the English, what happened in terms of the significance of what was to become New York City for slaveholding?
What many people don't know, or if they ever learned it, have since forgotten, and I certainly didn't realize this as I embarked on working on this project. New York City was, in the early 1700s, the second largest slaveholding city in what becomes the United States, in the 13 colonies, after Charleston. There was a massive slave population there, as well as a very large free black population. And slaves were absolutely essential to the early English colonial political economy. And they were also often quite militant. And so in the early 1700s, in 1711, there was a very large slave uprising, which a slave revolt, basically, which led to the death of a number of British colonists, but as well to a whole series of reforms in law and in policing, rules that made it illegal for African Americans, they weren't African Americans yet, for blacks to walk about at night without a lantern. So this is about early surveillance, right? Not more than two, I think it was, could gather at the water pumps, the tea pumps as they were called, at a time, because that's how information was exchanged. And yet even with all of that, there were still places where slaves and free blacks and workers who were not enslaved, white workers who were not enslaved, what were known as Spanish Negroes, who were basically Shanghai'd people from Spain who were indentured and sent to work in the sugar plantations and on the ships and so forth. There are places they would hang out, like in the some of the taverns along the wharves and so forth. They'd also exchange a lot of information all the way up and down the coast and into the Caribbean. And so there was these incredible networks of knowledge among slaves, non-slave blacks, other workers who were often allied with the slaves and free blacks and so forth. And this was a constant problem for the landowners, for other colonists in Manhattan, to the point where they were always afraid that there were Negro conspiracies, as they would call them, afoot. And in 1741, one of these conspiracies seemed to come to life. There's a lot of question about what really happened in 1741, but there was a whole series of fires in a place that was quite prone to fire, but a whole series of fires in the spring of 1741 that led landowners and authorities in Manhattan to think that there was a slave uprising at work, and a very big one. And there's a good chance that there was, and it probably was. And this led to this massive crackdown on slaves and free blacks, and the hanging, drawing and quartering, burning at the stake of dozens of black men and women, as well as an Irish innkeeper and his wife and daughter, a number of others as well, and the transportation of hundreds of others out of Manhattan to elsewhere in the slaveholding regions to try and break up these conspiracies, and a real sense that a new kind of order had to be put in place, a new, much more repressive sort of order to control slavery during that time. And so there's this long history of struggle between slaves and slave owners and others who were involved that shaped the early years of New York City through the Revolutionary War and into the 1800s. Slavery did not end in New York City until 1827, quite late compared to other places in the North. And so during that whole period, there was constant unrest by slaves.
And as you and your fellow authors write in Revolting New York, throughout the 19th century, there was a great deal of upheaval and the dialectic that you've been describing of revolt and then repression. But, of course, not all forms of revolt from below are liberatory. And so racist violence has also been part of the picture of upheaval in New York and elsewhere. Can you tell us about that story, especially as it relates to the 1863 draft riots?
Sure. There's prehistory that should go with this as well, which is that, you know, well before 1863, New York becomes a destination for working class Europeans who are being recruited to work in the factories that are beginning to be developed there, in the longshoring industry, and in all kinds of areas. And so it is, as you know, we think of New York City, an immigrant destination. And there was a great deal of competition between slaves up until 1827, or I should say slaveholders until 1827, free blacks before and after the final manumission of slaves in 1827, and working class whites, Europeans most particularly, and folks from what becomes Canada and so forth. A great deal of competition over jobs, over living space, and so on and so forth. And conditions in the growing immigrant and black quarters were often terrible. Workers and other people of power were not averse to setting different castes and classes, ethnic groups, religions, and races against each other. It was often to their profit to do so because it helped break up any kind of working class solidarity. And so it often helped to foment racist violence or just kind of sectarian violence between Protestant and Catholic Irish, for example. So all during the period, the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, New York is an amazingly violent place with a huge amount of sectarian warfare almost going on, as well as lynchings and other acts against African Americans. And much of this then comes to a head in 1863 during the Civil War, when a new draft law was going to be put into place. And one of the things that a lot of working class whites were upset about was that they felt that they were being drafted into what was clearly a very deadly war to fight to free African Americans, who many, of course, thought were inferior to them, to free African Americans to become competition for them. And then on top of that, the draft law allowed anyone with $300 to buy their way out of the draft. And so those two things together, and a lot more actually, led to a whole series of actions around the city as the draft was about to start in June, I think it was. It could be July of 1863. And a whole series of parades, protests, and attempts to stop the draft. And so the draft riots begin in many ways as a class-based riot of people really upset about this exemption for people with money from being drafted. But it becomes very, very quickly a race riot, or more accurately, a racist riot, in which whites start going after African Americans and lynching them, shooting them, and otherwise torturing them when they could catch them. African Americans would often fight back, of course. A lot simply fled the city as quickly as they could. And the the New York City government was very slow for lots of different reasons. Some is, I think, just a reluctance to act. Some of it is just incompetence. Some of it is rivalry between different political factions. But very slow to react, to bring in a police that won't aid and abet the rioters who are attacking African-American people, and to call in the National Guard, which was, in fact, very difficult at the time because many of those in the New York militia were in Pennsylvania on their way back, if I'm remembering my timing right, on their way back from Gettysburg. And so the riots raged for 4 days. And in those, they're the deadliest riots in U.S. history. And I believe they remain the deadliest riots in U.S. history. And they became, after they begin as a class kind of riot, they become an attack on black people. And part of it is this out-and-out racism, but some of it is this sense of a war that is being fought to create a competition for working-class white people whose hold on their jobs and in the city is already tenuous. And so there are a lot of complex forces that come together that create this incredibly violent moment.
Well, of course, as you're saying, there's some singular aspects to what took place during the draft riots, including the fact that it was in the middle of the Civil War. But you write that throughout the history of New York, and certainly through the 19th century, that there was little hesitation when those in power saw it warranted to deploy the military and certainly the police to put down revolts. Tell us about that and whether that extends into the 20th century as well.
It's a really remarkable story. The willingness to use military force against the residents of New York City is incredible. So all during the 19th century, even if they were often did very well, but all during the 19th century, authorities would call in first, I think it was the 7th Regiment and then the 27th Regiment. Its number changed at one point, and off the top of my head, I always mix it up. But they would call in the military, which is a voluntary army. It was usually white, usually middle or upper class people who were involved with it, who saw it as part of their duty to perform that sort of service. They drilled all the time. It's what many of the parks in New York City were built to allow for, is the military drills of the militia. And they would be called in often for things that you think of as, you know, very slight, like a plan by Protestant Irish to march from a stronghold on the west side of New York City in what's now kind of the Midtown area, north up to the Upper West Side for a commemoration of the Battle of the Boyne, which is a big day in the Protestant calendar. And the military would be brought out and would have very, very little reluctance to open fire and kill people. And it was just part of the process of revolt in New York City in the 19th century. And for many of us, as we're looking at this, it was kind of startling just how willing the government was to use the military to kill people, to kill residents of New York City. Often siding either with employers, as in the trolley strikes of the 1880s and the 1890s, or with particular factions of the working class or the political machine, like with Tammany Hall and so forth. But they were constantly being deployed. So not only in the draft riots in 1863, but in some riots in the area that's near Cooper Square now, in 1848, which was ostensibly about Shakespeare and the nature of a play being performed, but was really about the rivalries between Irish and other immigrant groups in New York City, and very much about political power in City Hall. So the military would be brought in for the smallest causes or the biggest ones, and would often open fire. And if you read the newspaper articles, you know, just kind of offhandedly, they would say, you know, 8 people were shot during the unrest yesterday, shot and killed during the unrest, as if it's a normal occurrence. And that continues into, I think, the 1880s. 80s or 1890s, and begins to change with the progressive era in many ways, with reforms in policing, with reforms in the sense of what militias are for, all those sorts of things. But I think mostly reforms in policing, with the professionalization of policing that happens beginning in the 1890s or into the 1910s, that the military is called out less and less frequently. And by the 1935 Harlem riot or the 1943 Harlem riot, while the National Guard is called out, their role in many ways is simply to patrol the streets. And by the 1960s, the 1964 Harlem riot, for example, or the anti-war unrest at Columbia, while again the National Guard is called out, and at times they can be quite brutal in ways, you know, that as we think about things now, they rarely open fire. And so there was a shift, with shifting in policing, shifting in kind of the sensibilities of how to go about maintaining order and so forth.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking today with the co-editor, along with the late Neil Smith, of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. That's published by the University of Georgia Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Don Mitchell is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden and professor emeritus at Syracuse University. So in the 20th century, the history of upheaval, of revolt, continued. And you mentioned race-based riots, Harlem riots in 1935, in 1943, in the 1960s, 1964. Tell us about the upheavals that were generated by concern or outrage about race, and those also about class and the degree to which they crossed over.
Probably one of the most interesting race riots was in 1900, when a young man by the name of Arthur Harris came out of a saloon, which is where the New York Times building is now, in fact, and saw a man accosting his wife. So Arthur Harris was black, and as was his wife. And so he stabbed the person who was accosting his wife, who turned out to be a police officer who was not in uniform. And then a few days later, the police officer died. This led to three nights of rioting that, as one newspaper reported, only ended when the mayor banned all white people from entering the Tenderloin. But what's important about that riot, as kind of a prehistory of the Harlem riots, is that that riot, like the 1863 draft riot, were attacks on black people. And they're very clearly attacks on black people by white people, including the cops. And in the 1935, 1943, and 1964 riots, which are often called, or almost always called, race riots, the African Americans and Puerto Ricans and others who were rioting were hardly ever attacked people. They almost always attacked property. They attacked property. Sometimes there's an anti-Semitic piece to this. They often targeted property owned by Jewish shopkeepers and so forth. But they particularly targeted shops that were owned by people who didn't live in the neighborhood or were perceived as gouging them and so forth. In each one of these riots, the spark was, and this will be no surprise to any listener, I don't think, the spark was police violence. The police apprehending someone and then beating them up or shooting them. In the case of 1964, 1943, policeman basically hitting a guy on the head with a billy club and then shooting him in the back. And so in each one of these cases, the rioting develops actually very, very quickly. After each of these moments of police violence, and spreads throughout Harlem into Spanish Harlem, into sometimes the African American neighborhoods, growing African American neighborhoods in Brooklyn and elsewhere, and in each case, it's property that is targeted. And it's very clearly property that is being targeted. So one of the things that we found in the book is that there is a real distinction that we need to understand when we think about race riots, that when it is whites attacking blacks, they are attacking blacks. When it is blacks uprising or rioting, they're attacking property. And that's a crucial, crucial distinction that gets lost in the way that we think about what rioting is, what it means, and what the grievances are all about. So what became clear in those three riots of Harlem was the way in which the uprisings were certainly about that moment of police violence, but just as much about the grievances of living in basically a place that is constantly being disinvested, that is operated through a whole series of racist practices in terms of housing, redlining, and all of that, and policing, and within which the merchants and others and landlords are understood basically to be colonists. And so there's this sense of the oppressed fighting back. And this was maybe explained the best by a mayor's committee in 1935 in the wake of the riot, which pointed out that for many of the rioters, what they felt they were doing when they were taking things from stores, when they were looting, was getting what they long deserved, but which had always been withheld from them. And so there was a sense that these were redistributional uprisings as well, that the long history of exploitation and oppression was being redressed through them. And that's what, you know, official government reports were arguing at the time as well. And I think that they're right, that they are redistributional in that sense. That
so hence they were about race and class at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They were about race and class at the same time. And those are I think, in many ways indistinguishable. I mean, they're obviously distinguishable, but they're indistinguishable in the ways in which the social fabric of New York City operates, that race and class map onto each other very, very tightly. And we can't talk about one without talking about the other.
The period of the 60s transformed the country, swept through the United States. How did the grievances and concerns and injustices that drove people into the streets elsewhere in the 60s manifest in New York in its particular context with its particular history in that period?
There were a couple of things that went on in New York that I think set it apart a little bit and put it right in the center of everything that was going on. There was, of course, a whole lot of anti-war activism, anti-nuke activism in the early 60s, pacifist activism from the 1950s. All that was always there. But as unrest develops over the Vietnam War, over in relation to the civil rights movement and so forth, a couple of things happen. One of them is that, as in lots of places, university campuses become real flashpoints. And the one that everyone knows about, and with good reason because it's important, is at Columbia University. And at Columbia, it wasn't just about the war, although that was important. The kind of research that the university was doing for the Defense Department, which was exposed by someone who just found some records basically in the library showing what they were doing, led to a great deal of unrest and organizing. So it was about the war, but it was also about Columbia's position between the growing wealth of the Upper West Side and the continuing to be exploited Harlem. And this became clearest in the university's desire to build a new gymnasium in Morningside Park. And this gymnasium was going to be on several floors and kind of cascaded down the hill into Harlem. And at the bottom, there was going to be a community access, which is basically one door that allowed people who lived in Harlem into the building, but only into parts of the building, like the lower floors. And all the luxurious stuff was going to be in the upper floors for the Columbia students. And so activists were able to link up the kinds of exploitative expansionary processes of the university with the ongoing exploitation of people in Harlem and kind of the growing sensitivity towards civil rights, equal access, all those sorts of things, the overwhelming whiteness of Colombia and so on and so forth. And so they began working on these issues, and then together anti-war activists and mostly black and a few Puerto Rican activists took over a series of buildings in 1968, in the spring of 1968, to contest both the gym and some of the wartime activities of the university. And one of the things that's really interesting that happens then is that the African-American students who've taken over one of the halls kick all the white students out and basically develop their own occupation. This is right at the moment when kind of black power ideologies are developing. But they're also a bit worried about the middle classness of the white activists. And so white activists end up taking over a whole other set of buildings. But there still is a lot of communication between the different parts of the movement at that time. So both anti-war and the kind of the changing structure of the university, access to it, the university's imprint on historically black neighborhoods in the area and that sort of stuff, all kind of come to a head in the way that they don't quite in other cities. And you can see that then gets played out in a whole series of other university occupations around the city, which are often about access to education. So in the City University of New York system, the whole series of buildings are taken over in 1969 to try and open up access to black and Puerto Rican students, particularly students from poorly performing high schools around the city, which leads to the universities being shut down, the National Guard being called back in, a number of quite violent episodes by the cops and others that were very much about access to education, but were also about the ways in which the world that we lived in was linked up. And so they weren't separate from anti-Vietnam War activism. People saw these of a piece. So that's one thing that happened. The other is that there was actually a very, very strong, as I think there was elsewhere in the United States, reaction to the student and other radical movements of the 1960s by middle and upper class people, certainly by capital in many ways, but also by working class whites. And this was not a particularly innocent process, but at one moment in 1971, I believe it was, a whole series of construction workers, mostly, attacked an anti-war rally on Wall Street and just started breaking heads, basically. It led to this great big melee in the city. And, you know, with hard hats, as they were called, chasing long hairs all around the city and so forth. But what's important about that is that many of these people who were engaged in what were called the hard hat riots were themselves being organized by, and the funding for their actions is being provided also by people very closely associated with Richard Nixon's presidential administration and his Dirty Tricks Fund. And so it wasn't just working class whites hated long hairs, but that there were a whole set of political machinations going on at the same time that led to this sense by the 1970s of a split in the movement between working class whites, for example, students who are understood to be privileged, white students who are particularly privileged, and between black and white students at the same time.
Geographer Don Mitchell is my guest. We're talking about the book Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So from the high point of the 60s and maybe the low point of the 70s that you're talking about, which of course has been made into an iconic moment, the hard hats versus the hippies, and projected onto the working class, not just of New York, but the United States, kind of without context, that working class people were pro-war and anti-hippie, when in fact, in America, the working class turned against the Vietnam War as well. But from that point, from the 70s, New York went through a roiling fiscal crisis, and you talked about the riots that took place in the summer of 1977. Looking back to that period, roughly speaking, marks the beginning of what often is called the neoliberal era. And it's often argued that protest and revolt has diminished during the neoliberal period for various reasons. Would you say that's fair to say about New York?
I would say that the nature of protest and revolt has shifted in the neoliberal era. I don't think it has ever faded. There have been at times a diminution of violence on the part of the police, for example, against protesters, not necessarily police violence overall, but against protesters, which is a very concerted effort on the part of a number of policing theorists, policing agencies, the military, and others to de-escalate force, as they call it, and then to negotiate protest rather than to kind of ban it altogether. That era of negotiated settlement or negotiated management of protest from the really the 1970s into the 1990s has itself now been supplanted with, again, an effort by the police to much more control people's protest actions than they had, not to negotiate them, but to dictate them in many ways, and then to use the failure to follow the dictates to engage in violence. And so we're seeing an uptick in violence around protest again, I think. But during that era, there was this diminution of violence, which was very much planned in many ways. This sense of negotiation or the ability to negotiate protests and so forth.
Was so that to changed. Try and prevent a backlash from a more heavy-handed approach?
Yes, I think it was. And I think it was also because, maybe this is saying the same thing, that that beating heads was seen by the end of the 1960s to not be a particularly effective policing strategy. And it tended to gain a lot more sympathy for protesters or rioters than actually not beating heads. And there was kind of a revulsion on the part of a lot of people's parts after, you know, the riots and Chicago of 1968 and a whole range of other sorts of actions that, you know, this is kind of revulsion. I think maybe wounded knee is important in this and so forth. So yes, it was this fear of a backlash and so then this concerted effort to do something else, to try a different way to police. But at the same time, things like, I think what we could think of as almost sectarian violence continue, which is often race-based, but it seems much more like the sectarian violence of the 1840s or 1850s, so the liberal era. In the late 1970s, 1980s, and so forth, it was often expressed as racialized because there are a number of riots in the 1980s, or I should say actually multifaceted struggles in the 1980s between, for example, Jews and blacks in Crown Heights after a quite important rabbi in his motorcade ran over two small black children, 4 years old. And in the wake of that, there was kind of a splintering of the black Jewish coalition that had been so important during the civil rights era. And that was in many ways, it was certainly race was at the center of it. And there was a lot of racist activity that happened during it, but it was very much like a sectarian kind of struggle, like between the Catholics and the Protestants and terms of control over space, control over power, all those sorts of things. Who's going to have a voice in City Hall? Those sorts of things get worked out in these kinds of struggles. And the other thing that returns in the 1970s, 1980s are struggles over housing that had in many ways faded by the 1930s or 1940s, I guess. And so struggles over housing is gentrification takes over. And these were expressed in defense of homeless people, in attempts to squat particular areas and so forth, and then police or governmental reactions to those, leading most famously to a big police riot in Tompkins Square Park in 1988 that the police actually lost, which kept the park open to people who were living in it for a while, maybe slowed down gentrification in the Lower East Side for a minute or two, and so forth, but really kind of exposed the ways in which questions of class and housing in the city are important. And those are issues that had faded by the end of the Depression, I think.
And then you mentioned that in the 1990s, there was a shift in policing and, of course, the rise of new movements. Of course, there was the period of Rudolph Giuliani as mayor and his zero-tolerance policing, and in the early 2000s, the global justice movement, the Republican National Convention. How did New York protesters and police square off against each other in ways that made clear that at least one side was studying the other and probably both?
Yes. Well, one of the things that happens at the end of the 1990s and into the 2000s is a revival of a kind of carnivalesque version of protest, which had been very important in New York City in the early 1800s. And there's this revival of it. So there's a lot of play, but it's very serious play that is really trying to overturn the order. And in many ways, the cops did not know what to do with this. They didn't quite understand what it meant for people to have a street party, right, or for something like critical mass to arise and to take over the streets in a way that was extraordinarily fun for a lot of people, as serious as they were. And they simply didn't know how to behave. They didn't know how to behave in the face of people who were dressed up like clowns or like butterflies in the community gardening struggles. And really brought in that sense of fun. But it was very serious fun that was being had. And so the police didn't know how to behave. And that clued a lot of people into the fact that the cops had very, very good abilities to monitor and to guess and to estimate how big a protest might be and to infiltrate often. And certainly by the time the internet develops, to lurk and to find out what's going on. And so protesters, organizers, people planning more violent actions and so forth tended then to use the fact that the cops were watching them to constantly try and fool the cops. And so there's this game of cat and mouse going on. And what results from that, I think, is what the sociologist Alex Vitali calls a new mode of policing called command and control, where the police are going to always maintain control of the streets and who's in the streets, under what kind of conditions they're going to be in the streets and during protest moments and so forth. And they will often do so in ways that are very unpredictable to the protesters themselves, so very quickly throwing up netting to kettle people, as it's called, to trap them and then hold them there until they can get IDs and all that kind of stuff, put them in holding pens out on the piers, all those sorts of things, but in ways that protesters themselves are not expecting quite often. At the last minute, changing parade routes, all those sorts of things. And so there's this constant game going on of the cops trying to command and control any kind of protest movement and protests themselves, and the protesters constantly trying to outwit the cops. And that has led for this kind of remarkable series all through the 2000s of skirmishes between protesters and cops and into the Occupy era over, you know, precisely where people will go, what they will do, what they can get away with, the degree to which they can close down streets or access to Madison Square Garden and that sort of thing.
And of course, that leads us to the recent present, to the explosion of Occupy Wall Street, which then inspired movements all around the country, to Black Lives Matter, to protests against Trump, of course, hails from Queens. How would you read the state of protest now in New York?
It's this moment that I think is actually quite unpredictable and maybe quite explosive. And it's not clear what the trigger might be, what kind of an explosion it might be. But I have a hunch that we're on the cusp of an era of pretty significant unrest, not only in New York City, but globally. It's not that we haven't been in one, but I think it's going to be intensified over the next years. And my sense of that comes from just paying close attention now to 400 years of history of these kinds of moments. And one of the things that is really clear in this book, and it's really remarkable, is that we were only able to find two decades when we could not identify basically violent uprising And those were the two decades between the Harlem Riot of 1943 and the Harlem Riot of 1964. So the kind of the high point of the post-Fordist social welfare settlement in the United States, which was not free of conflict, but there weren't the same kind of violent uprisings that we found for every other decade in those 400 years. And what those two decades were a moment of lessening inequality, of some breaks on the rapaciousness of capital, on a growing coalition of human rights and civil rights and other activists, and so forth, that were in many ways remaking the social and the spatial order of New York City as elsewhere. And so, but we're in a moment where that is all broken apart. And as we all know, inequality is very much on the rise. So are the rise of racist movements and so on and so forth. And it feels, again, in my reading, like the mid-1800s, the 1850s or the 1860s, and which are incredibly, incredibly explosive moments globally as well as in New York City. And I think we're on the cusp of something like that.
I've been speaking with geographer Don Mitchell. He is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden, professor emeritus at Syracuse University, and he's the co-editor with the late Neil Smith of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City, as published by the University of Georgia Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.